call it responsive case to Golden West's counterclaim. And as my understanding is that you were going to handle your rebuttal simultaneously. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Okay. Are there any preliminary matters before we begin?
I have just one, and maybe we can discuss this a little later when we see how our timing progresses. We have noticed one additional witness for rebuttal purposes, and that's Roger Musick. His schedule does not accommodate him being here other than today, and so if we need to deviate from the order, I would request that we cover his testimony today or before the day is out, whatever time that happens to be.
Mr. Weiserig?
I don't have a problem taking him out of order if the commission should decide to let him testify. I'm going to make an objection as to he's essentially an expert witness on facts that were well known before this hearing started, and he should have been disclosed, and he should have been in their case in chief. So I'm going to raise an objection at the time, but if we get pressed for time, we can certainly I can make that objection on the record then, and the commission can make a determination and take his testimony if they so decide.
Ms. Weiss, do you have a position? Okay, well, so noted, and why don't we start, Tal, with your case, and then we'll see how it goes, and we'll address that. What were you thinking, I mean, time-wise? Is this when's zero hour, I guess, for him?
We don't have a zero hour this evening. He has a flight out of Sioux Falls tomorrow.
Okay.
And so we would like to cover. He cannot be here tomorrow or the next day. So we would like
at all tomorrow.
That's correct.
Okay. Thank you.
And did you say how long you think his testimony will be?
I don't anticipate that it will be real long. Maybe 45 minutes, half hour, 45 minutes.
Ready to begin?
I thought you were looking at me for a comment.
Well, do you have a comment?
Well, I was just going to tell you, if you asked me how long I was going to take, I really don't know. The information I have on him was faxed to me Friday night, and until I hear his testimony, I can't even hazard a guess as to how long a cross-examination would take.
Why don't we begin with your case, then, Tal, and then we'll take that up. As I understand it, then, unless we're going to go on into the night, we would have to begin with him sometime around, say, 3:30 along in there?
I had perhaps anticipated we would go a little later this evening, but it doesn't matter to me, whatever time is convenient.
I guess we can deal with that later, but what did commissioners, do you guys have any preferences on whether to go on? I think
if we need to get the two witnesses done.
Okay. We'll see how it plays out then. If we don't have objections, then I think we can do that.
And just for the commission's information, Mr. Williams will be here tomorrow too. So if he goes in tomorrow, there's no problem there.
Okay, Mr. Weiserig, do you want to begin with your next witness?
WWC would call Ron Williams. Mr. Williams, you previously testified and set forth your background and positions with Altel, correct?
Correct.
And, in fact, took you a little bit out of order because it was actually you that had first contact with Larry Thompson regarding the inter-MTA studies, not Mr. Wilson. Is that correct?
That's correct.
All right. When you first, let me ask it this way, how did this original contact come about between you and Larry?
Well, we were in the process, the parties being at that time Western Wireless and a group of South Dakota telcos were had reached a settlement agreement, and we were in the process of then transitioning that settlement agreement into a complete interconnection agreement. There were still some language areas to resolve, and during the course of that dialogue, Larry was commissioned by the South Dakota telcos to work on the inter-MTA piece of our relationship.
I'm going to show you what's in front of you as WWC Exhibit 14 and GW Exhibit 7, which is right in front of you also, WW14 being the email strings. Do you recall when you were first contacted by Larry?
I believe it was summer of 2003.
Okay. There's a email contact in there where it appears you're responding to Mr. Thompson. Do you see that?
Yes, yeah, so July 25th, 2003.
Had you had a phone conference prior to that date?
Yes. I think it was part of probably a conversation with SDTA and Larry about moving forward with this aspect of the terms and conditions of the agreement.
When I'm going to also ask you to look at Golden GW7. There, the email references an attachment. Does GW7, is that a copy of that attachment?
Yes, it appears to be. This is a summary methodology of what we had used for an inter-MTA study in Oklahoma.
Okay, why were you providing Mr. Thompson a summary of that methodology?
Well, the parties were talking about what kind of study we would apply in South Dakota for inter-MTA, and this was something that we had done at that time fairly recently to produce some inter-MTA numbers for the state of Oklahoma.
When you say the parties, you represented WWC, correct?
Correct.
Who did Mr. Thompson represent?
Well, Mr. Thompson was representing all the SDTA member telcos that we had negotiated interconnection agreement with as a group.
Were you surprised that he was representing 25, 30 companies all at once?
Well, not really. I mean, that had been the relationship we've had with the South Dakota telcos, both with respect to the immediate interconnection agreement we were dealing with, but also in our prior relationships with them. We'd done a previous agreement, maybe back in 2000, or that was a group negotiation between Western Wireless and a group of South Dakota telcos. The agreement that this was relevant to was also a group negotiation where the group of South Dakota telcos was represented by SDTA. So Larry's participation as a representative of the group wasn't out of character.
When in those past negotiations, have you negotiated essentially individual rates with every company?
Well, group negotiations have a really different dynamic than individual one-on-one negotiations. In our group negotiations with the South Dakota telcos, we had negotiated as a group, but in the end, compromises were made on both sides where we didn't treat each company individually, but we broke the carriers into different groups for the purposes of coming to resolution on rates primarily. So it's a different dynamic. The dynamic is, of course, if you've got one player or a couple players in a group that aren't going to be satisfied, then, it stymies progress for the entire group.
When Mr. Thompson contacted you, did he advise you as to whether VPS had ever done an inter-MTA study?
I think both companies were relatively green. I mean, Western, we had undertaken this study in Oklahoma. It was the first time we'd ever attempted any such study. And it was my understanding at that time that nobody else in the industry had really done an inter-MTA study.
Okay. You talk about this Oklahoma study. Can you explain for the commission what that entailed?
Well, yeah, it was a study that took, again, it was an attempt to get MTA or inter-MTA traffic for a group of LECs in Oklahoma. And the study was relatively simplistic in that it took data from our cell sites, where calls originate on our cell sites, and captured that data, and then we and identified only those calls that were going to a rural LEC, NPA, NXX, or number block. And then from there, we associated the call with what, or the cell site that the traffic came off of, with what MTA the cell site was in. That was pretty much it.
Did that data include IXC bound traffic?
It did. We studied the traffic coming into our switch from our cell sites. We didn't pay any attention to how it was leaving our switches. So some of the traffic could have been delivered on direct trunk groups to the telcos, some of it via SBC transit, and some of it would have been delivered via IXCs.
So was that study an attempt to get an absolute peer number for inter-MTA traffic?
No, it was a study that was feasible given the capacity we had for this kind of data and given what we were trying to accomplish, which was to get something indicative or reasonable in terms of what the traffic might be. And again, another difference, the study was based on messages, so it was the number of calls as opposed to minutes per, and things like other details like that.
Okay. So in your email, you provided this to Mr. Thompson just as a sample of one thing that you had attempted to do.
Yeah, I mean, we'd use this. It served its purpose in Oklahoma, and we hoped it would serve its purpose in South Dakota.
What was Mr. Thompson's response to that proposal?
His response came a few months later in the form of a counterproposal or another proposing a different methodology.
Okay, and you're looking at, I guess I'd ask you to turn to email string 3 of Exhibit 14, which is an go to email email string 3. Could you explain to the commission what that is? Via email of Monday, October 20th.
This is a response. Larry in mid-September had sent us an outline of a methodology for inter-MTA study. And my email of October 20th was, after having a chance to review that, was my response to it. Basically, it said, had a chance to review it. Some parts of it seem reasonable, but we have some real issues with some specific components of the study and the results that it would produce.
Did Mr. Thompson ever reply to you or reply to that email answering those questions?
No.
Did he ever reply to you answering those questions?
He never responded to me with in answers to these questions.
The as the matter then progressed, there are some emails that follow in December exchanging some data regarding Missouri. Could you explain to the commission what was going on in regards to Missouri?
Well, we had done a similar study in Missouri that was similar to what we had done in Oklahoma for the same kind of similar situation. We had we were engaged in a negotiation with a group, a small group of LECs there, and InterMTA was part of that discussion. So we produced a study. It was the same methodology that we had used in Oklahoma, although it was much simpler because it in Missouri we only have a little portion of that state, and we only had 8 or 9 cell sites involved in that, and there were only five or six telcos involved.
Okay. The how did you go about being able to pull this information? Were you able just to ask for it and have it pulled instantaneously?
No. Well, it was a request we made, and this was an informal request I had made to our billing group who handles this kind of data that comes off of our switches. And I requested, described to them, had a series of meetings where we described what the problem was and to see how they could go about gathering data to satisfy the problem. It was clearly a non-standard process that they went through, and it took some time for them to identify both a clear way to get the data and a way that they could do it in the construct of how they were processing data through their systems.
WWC is a CMRS carrier, correct?
Correct, wireless CMRS.
Does your billing department capture the same kind of detail coming off a switch that LEC may?
No. The detail that we use that comes off of our switch is used exclusively for billing our consumers. We don't have a wholesale billing process where we would bill other carriers, for example, for access or even for reciprocal compensation. It's just a machinery that we have never invested in. The wireless community as a whole hasn't made much investment in because it's not a revenue stream for us, and we don't have the kind of convoluted rate structure that LECs have to deal with on a wholesale rating basis.
When Mr. Wilson was testifying, he was asked if you don't do these studies and get down to the numbers, how do you actually set these rates, or how can you come up with a reasonable methodology? Could you respond to that?
Well, I mean, the rates are, like anything in a wireless interconnection agreement, it's subject to balancing of interests and an understanding of where trade-offs are, and that dialogue between two carriers is then is supplemented by whatever information is available to the parties. And more often than not, the parties find some common ground based on relatively limited data, particularly with respect to InterMTA, but that might be true with respect to traffic volumes. It might be true with respect to balance of traffic. Interconnection negotiations have a lot of issues associated with them, and it's a balancing of all of those issues as to what the negotiated result would be.
When trying to come up with a reasonable InterMTA analysis or numbers, does the actual cost of having to do studies come into play?
Oh, certainly. And that probably relates mostly to how much total opportunity is at stake. I mean, certainly.
I'm sorry. What do you mean about total opportunity at stake?
Well, I mean, if you're trading traffic with another carrier and you trade 1 million minutes a month, you might pay a different level of attention to that than if you're trading 1,000 or 10,000 minutes a month.
So the smaller the carrier, the more likely you'd be to try to negotiate the rates or come up with some quick study.
I guess that would be no secret, but, I mean, yeah, obviously larger volumes may have larger financial impact, and we might take negotiations on a different tack.
The going through Exhibit 14, there comes a time where you ask Mr. Wilson to have contact with Mr. Thompson on this issue. You recall that?
I do.
When was there a reason that you asked Mr. Wilson to take this task over?
Well, Mr. Wilson came to work for me in November of 2003. Part of his duties and part of his experience had to do with data and data derivation to support interconnection and some of the other compliance tasks we were vested with. Mike had experience with data and with the kind of software he would use to manipulate data, and he had experience with Western's systems, billing systems, and other software access tools. So it's the appropriate candidate for that job.
So when you assigned it to him, it then appears that he made a proposal about 3 months later. You turn to email string of 14. Appears as number 8.
Can you provide me the date?
The date would be September, as top of the page Larry's response.
Yes.
Yeah. Do you know whether Mr. Wilson had contact with Mr. Thompson or people at VPS during the intervening time period?
Yeah, the intervening time period would be second and third quarter of 2004. I believe that Mike, at least he represented to me, that he had various phone calls with Larry. I know when we were here for the L&P hearings during that summer, a couple different times, I know they talked at that point in time. I'm sure there was contact ongoing.
Okay. The proposal made by Mr. Wilson to Mr. Thompson, is that more complicated than that was done in Oklahoma?
It appears to be slightly more complicated, but it seems to be, it was developed based on what we had previously done in Oklahoma. It was kind of an extension of that with a few additional data elements, it appears. And obviously a very different network topology involved in South Dakota traffic versus what we had in Oklahoma.
Could you explain what you mean by network topology?
Well, all I mean is how our network is set up and what portions of our network are relevant to a study. In Oklahoma, all of our operations, at least at that time in Oklahoma, were switched out of a single switch that wasn't connected to any of our other switches. In South Dakota, when we initiated this, we had two switches in South Dakota that weren't connected at the time, and we had an MTA situation here that involved data from states in North Dakota and Minnesota, as well as South Dakota.
When you say the two South Dakota switches weren't connected at the time, did during this process at some point an interconnection between those two was put in place?
Yes, intermachine trunking was put in place between the Rapid City and Sioux Falls switches, and then that continued, and over time, the interconnection or intermachine trunking, inter-switch trunking was put in place between our switch and switches in North Dakota as well, and maybe even our Nebraska, one of our Nebraska switches.
Okay, on your North Dakota switches, once the intermachine trunking is in place, those would deliver through your switches into South Dakota for South Dakota calls made to South Dakota, correct?
Correct.
So where in Oklahoma you only had to capture data from one switch, here you'd have to capture from both South Dakota and North Dakota switches?
Yeah, I think there were, I believe there were ultimately four switches involved in the data capture for South Dakota.
The how about number of towers? Does that make a difference on the proposal that Mr. Wilson made in September of 28th of 2004?
Well, it does. The tower data has to be collected and identified and verified, and it has to be synced up on at the time frame you take the study. And just because of where our coverage area was or is in this area, we had a much broader, larger in scope, many more cell sites to deal with in the study for South Dakota than we did for Oklahoma.
Okay, and just so it's clear, is the actual MTA of a tower part of the information provided on a switch? Is it part of an information field that's part of a switching data?
No, not to my knowledge, and I think Mike testified that he needed to associate the data in a call record with a separate table that had data about cell sites.
He talked about doing running it through translation tables.
He may have used that term.
Okay. The there was some implication that Mr. Wilson, before making this proposal, was purposely dragging his feet in making this proposal. Do you have an opinion on that?
Well, I'm pretty sure he wasn't dragging his feet. This was admittedly a busy time for us. This was the, if you will, the summer of LNP. There was a lot of other issues on the table during that time frame, but this remained going into that before we knew how difficult the LNP issue would be. This was one of the priority projects for Mike, and you know it remained so during this time frame.
Did you ever advise Mr. Wilson to drag his feet on providing information to VPS?
Never.
Did anybody at the company ever advise him to do that?
Not to my knowledge.
The you recall soon after this proposed study methodology. Well, first of all, this just so we can distinguish, but the actual proposal that Mr. Wilson made in September and that Mr. Thompson responded to, is that what was used to pull the or mine the data from the switch when the records were produced during discovery?
My understanding that this method or something very similar to what appears in this September 28, 2004 email was what was used to generate some inter-MTA data in, I think it was late October of 2004.
Okay. So this methodology, and do you recall Mr. Wilson testified that he called VPS and they picked five RLX to pull the data for?
That's my understanding.
Okay. When they selected the five RLX, did he run those by you at all?
Well, he suggested that they were going to do a sample of a subset of the LEX, and I said, well, make sure it's a balanced mix.
Why did you care about it being a balanced mix?
Well, if we were going to do a sample, something that was representative of the situation so that we could use that to resolve for the entire group of LEX.
How would you use the sample to resolve the entire group?
Well, again, I think it gives my view of it, it would give the parties enough data points where we could negotiate resolution of inter-MTA factors for all the rest without having to do 30 different studies.
Did there come a time where Mr. Wilson told you that VPS had reported back that at least some of his clients weren't willing to take a negotiate from a representative sample?
Well, it seems to me in winter or spring, sometime in March maybe of 2005, Mike shared with me that the sample with five companies that we chosen were going to be inadequate from BPS's perspective, and they wanted us to run more studies.
Okay. At that time, had VPS agreed to be bound by any of the studies that you had run?
No. In fact, that was an ongoing issue and an ongoing pushback I gave to Mike was that, I thought we were doing an extraordinary amount of work without an agreement on what the work was going to produce or whether we were going to be able to actually use the results to move forward with this. And so my pushback to Mike over this entire time frame was, let's get a methodology before we put any more energy into the study process.
I'm going to ask you to look at Exhibit 14, email string 13, which is the February 5th, 2005 email from Larry Thompson.
All right.
Have you seen that email before?
Yes.
When Mr. Thompson provided this response, what was your understanding as to whether there had been an agreement reached as to what methodology to follow?
Well, I was operating under the impression that the sampling methodology was going to be satisfactory to resolve these inter-MTA issues. And this email indicated to me that we still hadn't, Larry was of the opinion we still hadn't agreed upon a method for determining inter-MTA factor.
If you, the second page of that email actually lists four items that Mr. Thompson wants to address. Is that correct?
Correct.
The second item talks about changing the methodology that had been proposed by Mr. Wilson to base the inter-MTA factor on minutes as opposed to messages. Do you see that?
I do.
Was that the first time that you know that Mr. Thompson raised this complaint about Mr. Wilson's proposed study that he made back in September?
It's the first time I was aware of it, I believe.
Okay. The why was it important to you before you continued to expend funds doing these studies to at least have some type of agreement on methodology?
Well, there are a number of different dynamics, but we were and had invested a lot of money and time and energy into this. And we also, if we were going to develop a methodology, we needed to make sure that methodology would reconcile with what we had to do in other, other locations relative to inter-MTA. And so we wanted something that was, that we could replicate, not just for South Dakota, but that we could use in other states where this came up. And so I was interested in understanding, trying to put more structure on what it was we were going to try to do in South Dakota. And I thought we'd spent plenty of resource to date and should have been, would hope be able to get agreement on the methodology based on what we've done.
Okay. Was it your understanding that Mike's proposal in September was an attempt to come up to a reasonable measurement of inter-MTA traffic?
It was designed and intended to do that, reasonable in terms of what result it might produce and reasonable in terms of our capacity and bandwidth for producing a study.
Okay. Does the fact that in negotiating this study, the fact that Mr. Thompson would want to apply to 30 separate companies, could you explain why the representative sample and negotiating from the representative sample made business sense?
Well, I mean, I think it made business sense. That was the basis we'd negotiated everything else with these companies before. In this business, we do a lot based upon, kind of an 80% understanding or a best estimate of what a situation is, knowing that whatever we decide at one point in time is only our best estimate because this is a pretty dynamic industry we're in, and it's not just about what happened last month or last quarter. It's about where your business is going in terms of growth, in terms of how you're managing your network, in terms of what kind of customer base you've got going on, and in terms of what other external events, competitive events mostly, are occurring. So it's common practice for us to use a study or a small sample to project on how we would deal with a bigger relationship. And again, like I say, it was in this case a practice we'd used with the South Dakota telephone companies several times prior.
If you take a company like Faith, which is very small, or even Kennebec, which I believe Mr. Bauer testified earlier in this proceeding, does it make sense to expend significant effort on doing studies for those smaller companies from a business standpoint?
I don't think it makes sense for either side. I think, finding an area of resolution through dialogue and negotiation probably is a much more efficient process than beating each other to death with studies.
Is one of the worries that the cost of the study can quickly exceed what's going to exchange hands?
Not just the case of that's true. For us, doing data extraction and traffic studies is not something we do in a normal course of business. So there's a high cost for us to produce a threshold. But it's not only that, it's the maintenance. The maintenance of study is also, for us, that would be inventing a whole new, a whole new process. I mean, it's a tremendous amount of inertia to do a one-off deal, and there's a level of operating cost and maintenance that would be significant if we had to sustain a study practice.
So, say 30 RLX in South Dakota. When you say that, if you had to do this study for all 30 RLX, and then I believe the agreement calls for the study to be done every 6 months. Recall that.
Yes.
Does that impact whether you would find an agreement? Does that provide a is there? Well, let me back up. I'm not sick anymore, and I don't have any excuses. So, does that impact on coming up with what you believe is a reasonable study?
Yeah, I mean, I think doing the maintenance work for companies where there's relatively small financial relationship, it doesn't make sense to me to implement ongoing measurement relationships and
Or would it be fair to say that you might, whether you're going to use a study for some one size company, you might do a more simplistic study than for a different size company?
Well, or average or project based on some data you do have. Yeah.
The returning to Mr. Thompson's email of February 5th, 2005, he provides some information on SS7 data that he's pulled. Do you see that?
I believe, yes, he's providing some information for Venture Communications.
Had Mr. Thompson ever previously provided SS7 data to the best of your knowledge?
Not to my knowledge, no.
So it appears at this point he's proposing potentially to use the SS7 data instead?
I think he is proposing this as an alternative, and you know, and in this instance, the difference between what was calculated with our data and what was calculated from the SS7 data there's about a 15% overall difference, but it seems pretty close. The difference between 4.6% and 5.4%.
Did Mr. Thompson ever provide you the SS7 analysis for the Golden West companies?
I believe it was provided as part of discovery for this case.
But not before this went to litigation?
Correct.
The there was some discussion. I'm going to ask you to turn to the last email on the in that attachment, or in that exhibit 14. There was some discussion about this offer. Was this an offer to all the RLEX that Mr. Thompson was representing?
Yes, this was an offer that Mike made on behalf of Western Wireless at that time to resolve inter-MTA for all the ILEX based upon the data that came out of the sample study.
Was there there was implication in some of the cross-examination of Mr. Wilson that this was made in bad faith? Do you have an opinion on that?
I don't think it was made in bad faith at all. It was a fair offer to resolve the differences.
Why do you believe it was a fair offer?
Well, you know, for a number of reasons. I mean, it was meant to resolve across the board for all the LEX. It was represented about a 60% increase in the inter-MTA factor from where we had been. The inter-MTA factor in here, 5%, is the same factor, for example, we have with Quest in the state of South Dakota. And given the uncertainty and the amount of errors we saw in the methods that had produced data so far, that all things considered, this was a fair and reasonable offer.
Did VPS ever respond to that offer?
Well, I think they did. I mean, they told us it was insufficient.
Did they ever respond with that offer proposing for any of the companies how they should resolve this?
No.
Not just the Golden West companies?
No. I mean, the response we got at the time was they didn't like this offer. And then it was a couple months later where we got basically demand letters from a lot of the South Dakota LEX that basically demanded implementation of the SS7 study results that Larry had run.
And was that the first time you saw the SS7 study results from these other companies?
I believe so.
At this time, at the time that offer was made in April of 2005, had VPS ever said to WWC, "We agree to use the following analysis"?
No.
There's we talked about some of these studies. There was some testimony, I believe, by Mr. Thompson that stated that once you do the study, it's easy to do another one. Do you agree with that?
No, because our network changes every week, and the elements from our network that go into these studies have to be tracked and validated, and that could include changes in network configurations, changes in homing configurations to our switches, changes, overlays of new technologies. All of those would basically require adjustments to the methodology that you would use.
What is homing configuration to switches?
Well, all of our cell sites are connected to a single switch. Think of the cell sites as subtending a switch. In order to do balancing among our switches, sometimes we rehome cell sites so that two switches in an area can remain balanced in terms of the traffic they're carrying.
So an example would be if you have a cell site outside of Pier, it might be honed to the rapid switch at one point, but then honed to the Sioux Falls switch later on?
That could happen.
The how does the increased number of towers impact studies going forward?
Well, every time you implement a tower or establish a new tower, you've got to add that into the database. And when we think about towers, we think about the pole that's out in the field with the radios on top of it. But it's not just a new tower. It's sometimes a whole new technology we would deploy on the same tower that we have. And because it's a different technology, it goes through a different process to get back to the switch. Over a year's time frame, we might deploy 15 or 20 or 25 towers. We also might deploy 30 or 40 technology overlays. And in South Dakota particularly, we deploy temporary cell sites. We call them cellular on wheels or cellular on light truck, cows and colts, and they get deployed for significant events. And those, depending on when you're doing your study, those need to get factored in. Or
the Altel's in the process of acquiring a cellular provider in Minnesota. Is that correct?
That's correct.
If you acquire a new provider, especially in a neighboring state like that, does that have an impact on how you do a study going forward?
Well, sure. All of the cell sites and the switching fabric and the routing associated with that acquisition and how that acquisition is integrated into our existing network has to be has to be incorporated into the database.
So it's not a simple matter of plugging in the same software program 6 months later for a wireless carrier.
Well, not at all. And I look at what we've just done. We've got a company coming in Minnesota where we're going to ultimately be acquiring them and all of their facilities. They overlay our network there in some respects, and there's going to be probably a 18-month process where we integrate those two networks into an efficient result where we've got now either redundant towers or redundant backhaul facilities or maybe redundant switching facilities. The process of grooming all that so that we get an efficient result is going to take about 18 months. We're in the process right now in Nebraska where we've just had to divest some properties in Nebraska because of the overlap situation when Altel acquired Western Wireless. That's a very complicated process because we've got two technologies sitting on the same cell site, and one of those technologies we're keeping, and the other one we're getting rid of, or we've sold off to U.S. Cellular. And so now we've got, for every one of those, we've got a process where we've got to basically replicate the cell site identification, reroute the traffic, and rehome the traffic. That process was begun last year and won't finish until middle of 2007.
Does that have an impact on how you could do a study like this in the future?
I don't know today how I'd do a study in Nebraska that we wouldn't spend a heck of a lot of time on maintaining database because the project has changes the way the network looks on a weekly basis.
The did the difficulty with reaching in some type of a well, did the failure to be able to reach a mutually agreed study with VPS, did that surprise you?
To reach a mutually agreed study?
The fact that you couldn't reach that.
Well, I mean, I think it frustrated me to no end. And I think part of it was that, you know, it's hard when you've got are representing 25 different interests at the table, and the compromise solution looks good for 15 of them, but not for 10 of them. It frustrated me because I thought we could resolve this like we had resolved other issues with the South Dakota group at telcos because we'd taken them as a group, and sometimes we'd subgroup them based on certain characteristics, and then that's basically how we ended up with the reciprocal compensation rates that were in effect for these agreements. We started off negotiating a rate, one-size-fits-all rate, and ultimately we negotiated four different rates for four different groups of telcos. And I hadn't expected this to head in the same direction.
And was it your understanding when you did these sampling companies that that's the direction this inter-MTA methodology was going, this group analysis?
Well, it certainly seemed like the most efficient path.
Okay. There was some testimony by, I believe, Mr. Thompson that these an inter-MTA study is not very expensive to do. Do you agree with that?
No. We did two studies without any agreement, and we spent, more than $30,000 on each study. And to me, that's a lot of money to spend on a study to begin with. And secondly, it's a lot of money to spend when you don't have agreement that the study is going to count for anything.
There was a, I believe this was proposed in Mr. Law's spreadsheets for a retroactive application of inter-MTA rates to 18 months earlier. Do you recall that?
Retroactive application, yes.
Do you see problems with retroactive applications of inter-MTA rates taken at a point in time?
Well, I do. And again, it's because our, we don't have a historical study point that, you can trend inter-MTA data on. There's no, these were the first studies that we'd ever done in this area. Nobody else has done studies in this area to my knowledge. So there's no other reference points to do any kind of a trending analysis. But even if there were, given what's happened in our network over the last 2 years, recount some of the things that have gone on. We've had, in the area that we've studied for this, four states, we've added 40 or 50 cell sites during that time frame. We've opened up new markets. We've changed our rate plan. We've changed our customer mix. We've implemented number portability, which in this state alone had an enormous impact on customer base, and also the nature of those customers. So what we've got over this course of time is a continually evolving set of dynamics that really would make it hard to extrapolate any kind of a rate from a single point in time.
Show you what's in. I'm going to hold this. This is WWC Exhibit 29. Or excuse me, it's Golden Blessing Exhibit 29.
Can you guys make at least an effort to get your voices on the mics? I've been admonished to attempt to achieve that. Thank you, and I don't want to distract you, Tal, but
no, that's fine.
That might pick it up at that far away. I'm sorry.
I apologize. I'm feeling so good, I don't think I need it anymore. So, it appears from 2004 to 2005, traffic use in the Vivian area has almost doubled.
Yes, from about 9 million to 15 million. In 1 year period.
And so, and do you know why that substantial increase in usage has occurred?
Well, probably a couple of reasons. Most significant among them in this case was we turned up what we would think of as a new market in the Rosebud Reservation and got rapid penetration and added just a number of customers in that area, and you know, in addition to that, we've had a changing mix of rate plans that also encourage more usage for all of our existing customers.
So the if you tried to extrapolate back, you would end up in a whole different type of market that didn't exist a year ago.
Well, our customer base at the end of 2005 was dramatically different than our customer base at the beginning of 2005. And that would be true for any period on this chart.
The
thank you. There was a.
Can I get it?
Sure.
I gotta get the mic lined up too. During Mr. Thompson's testimony, there was discussions regarding a couple of interconnection agreements. Do you recall that?
Yes, I do.
Marked as exhibits Golden West 5, 17, and 18 were some interconnection agreements. Did you look at those after they were marked?
I did at the time.
I believe the implication was those agreements were indicative of how InterMTA is handled in the industry. Do you agree that they're indicative of how they're handled in the industry?
No, they're an example of how InterMTA had been negotiated in some instances, but they're not representative of what has been negotiated throughout the industry. They're just one example.
Sorry, I think it's mark
Nice save.
using.
The, could you identify what exhibit number 18 is for the commission, please?
Exhibit 18 is a collection of several interconnection agreements that includes the first page of the agreement, a page that represents the inter-MTA terms of that agreement, the signature page, and in cases where there is a rate or factor attachment, that's included as well. These are all interconnection agreements that have been negotiated between two parties and are indicative of other agreements in these jurisdictions that have been negotiated as to, you know, what the inter-MTA rates are and what the inter-MTA factors are. These are again, representative of negotiated resolution of inter-MTA conditions in the industry.
Okay. There was a on the interconnection agreements provided by Ms. Rogers when she was cross-examining Mr. Wilson on it. She referenced a study methodology in the Wisconsin agreement with between Altel and the Wisconsin company. Do you recall that?
I do.
Was there some special considerations in that agreement that aren't present in RLX in South Dakota?
Excuse me, could we just clarify which agreement we're talking about there?
The Wisconsin agreement that you produced was, I believe, marked as Exhibit 18 between Tri-County Telephone and Altel.
Thank you.
Well, in the circumstances of that agreement, I think it was that it was an attempt to disparage Mike's testimony, but in reality, Mike had no participation at all in the negotiation of that agreement. It was a negotiation that was had been in process prior to when Altel acquired Western Wireless. It was negotiated by a different individual. It was negotiated with a LEC that was part owner in Altel's wireless license in Wisconsin. And I guess, and the result is what was reflected in the terms and conditions in that.
The, as to Exhibit 18 and 19, could you explain to the Commission what Exhibit 19 is?
Well, Exhibit 19 draws on the information that's contained in 18 in the sense that it's a summary of interconnection agreements in the state of Minnesota that have the identical terms and conditions as the one that's represented in here in Exhibit 18. And let me just walk through Exhibit 18 so you understand what is in front of you. The first is an interconnection agreement between LUC Telephone and Altel Communications, the parent of Western Wireless. The second page includes the definitions for inter-MTA traffic in 4.4 and the inter-MTA percentage or inter-MTA factor in 4.5 provides basically pointers to attachment 2, which is also provided for you. And in attachment 2, it identifies an inter-MTA rate of 3.5 cents, and it identifies an inter-MTA percentage of 5%. This clearly is the result of both a negotiation as to rate and as to percentage in this agreement. The second agreement here is Cannon Valley Telecom. This is a Minnesota company and is one of the 35 or so represented on Exhibit 19. The agreement terms and conditions for all of those Minnesota LECs are the same as to InterMTA. And page section 5 of the agreement is attached and identifies that the CMRS, which is in this case Western Wireless, shall compensate carrier, which in this case is the LEC Cannon Valley, for wireless to wireline inter-MTA traffic at carrier's interstate switched access tariff rate.
If I could just interject something here for purpose of possible objection. The witness is going through and actually testifying as to what is in each one of these pages, and the exhibit has not been offered yet. It would appear to me he can give a general identification, and then we can decide whether or not we have any objections to its admission into evidence. But to testify off the exhibit before it has been offered, we would object to that.
Do you have a problem with that, Mr. Wysarek?
No, I don't. Okay. And in fact, I'll just clarify. These are Exhibit 18 is the relevant pages of multiple interconnection agreements. Is that correct?
Correct.
And rather than mark the entire interconnections agreements because of their size, is my understanding you'd offer these just to, in contrast to those interconnection agreements previously offered by Golden West companies.
That's correct. Each of these agreements is anywhere from 20 to 35 pages long, and we just pulled the relevant portions here. All of these agreements are filed with the respective commissions in these states.
And these agreements are agreements that were either Western Wireless agreements or are Alltel agreements after the merger. Is that correct?
With one exception, I've included a U.S. cellular agreement for the state of Texas, which is basically what U.S. cellular did was opt into the Western Wireless agreement with Santa Rosa Telephone.
Okay. I'd move for admission of 18 and 19.
I would, for the record, I guess, like to state an objection to just admitting the selected pages from the agreements. We might disagree as to whether all of the relevant language in these agreements is included with this offering. I haven't had a chance to review specifically, each of the pages for each of these, and we have ourselves obtained some full copies from Mr. Wysarek, and we would like the entire agreements to be put into the record rather than just portions.
Is that objectionable? I don't think necessarily, unless Golden West is going to tender some kind of counter evidence based on those agreements, that we necessarily all need to have a stack that's 3 feet high here. But in terms of just making those available and marking them, Tal, is that a problem?
I don't have a problem if, rather than give you a whole stack, I think I've got an extra copy of each of them I brought in case there was questions on it, and I mark those if that's the preference for the purposes of the record.
Ms. Weiss, do you have a position?
I think that would be sufficient. I know at the beginning of the hearing we had requested that the entire agreements that they had put in be put in, so
nothing
that's fine with us.
It's the goose and gander principle. Why don't we do that, and if you want to, I think we can do that without everybody here. We'll mark those and introduce the totality of the agreements into the record. And then I think anybody here that wants a copy of those can either review those or get a stack, and we can copy them downstairs.
Did you want me to do that now, Mr. Smith? Or
no, unless, no, let's conclude. Let's proceed, and we'll do that at some time when we're not all sitting here. Okay. Thanks. Proceed.
Well, I'm moving 18 and 19 for admission, subject to that. I will provide the full copies of interconnection agreements marked as 19, or excuse me, as 18. And 19 simply being a list of identical interconnection agreements entered in Minnesota.
Can you clarify how many agreements are included in your WWC 18, what's been offered as WWC 18?
There are eight.
Thank you. No objection. As long as we can get copies of the entire agreement.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Coit?
The only reason primarily that we're insisting upon this is I think we may have some questions with respect to other parts of the agreement.
Okay, thank you. Exhibits 18 and 19 are admitted.
Exhibit 20 in front of you could explain to the commission what that is.
Yes, this is an excerpt from our agreement with U.S. West or Quest in the state of South Dakota.
And does that address InterMTA?
Yes, it does. It addresses it in this context as non-local or InterMTA traffic. And it identifies a default percentage for that traffic and identifies that the traffic will be InterMTA traffic will be billed at interstate access rates.
The and this is a portion of your filing with Quest that you have here in front of in South Dakota.
That's correct.
I'm going to move for the admission of 20.
Kind of a similar comment on this. It's my understanding that this is on file with the commission. We would just ask that the commission, you know, I don't know if the best approach is to just take judicial notice of the entire document or whether, you know, I don't think we need another copy put into the record because I think it's already on file with the commission. But certainly we haven't had a chance yet to kind of review what pages we've got here versus what other pages are in the agreement.
Is this a filed agreement?
It's my understanding it's a filed agreement, correct.
It's a filed agreement. I think this was also provided as part of discovery.
It was provided as part of discovery back in, I believe, November.
I think we can, if it's filed with the commission, we can take judicial notice of it as an official document of the commission.
The I'm going to move then. I move for admission of 20 then.
No objection.
No objection.
There was a
Western Wireless Exhibit 20 is admitted.
There was some contention that to charge to allow you to deliver InterMTA traffic and not charge you intrastate rates would be discriminatory. Do you remember that?
I do.
But it doesn't appear that Quest has an issue with that.
Not at all.
Do you believe there's also testimony regarding the fact of how your traffic is delivered and how interstate rates should be calculated given the tariffs. Do you recall that testimony?
Yes, I do.
Did Mr. Thompson, in calculating the interstate rates applicable to traffic, take into consider or use the actual route WWC uses to deliver that traffic?
It's my understanding Mr. Thompson's calculation used a route that assumes that the traffic flows through SDN's Sioux Falls Tandem. Our traffic, the traffic at issue here, does not route through the Sioux Falls SDN Tandem. It's delivered through Quest Tandems or it's delivered directly to the telcos. That differential accounts for a substantial differential in terms of the transport mileage that would be applied to the traffic. And
Do you recall that there was an argument, I believe, by Mr. Thompson, that he had to do this because of an FCC decision from 1990?
I do recall that.
Did you review that decision?
I did.
Do you agree with his conclusion?
I do not. I don't, because that decision was really based upon a public interest decision to, in essence, establish a monopoly for the deployment of equal access in the state of South Dakota. It was specific to IXC traffic, did not involve CMRS traffic, and it, more, perhaps most significantly, it predated the Telecom Act of 1996.
Is WWC an IXC?
We are not.
For the record, what is? Could you define what the what an IXC is? What does IXC stand for?
Interchange carrier, in essence, a toll carrier.
The if you have actually built your network out to some of these companies, haven't you?
Built direct connections to some of the telcos?
Yes.
Yes, we have.
And if you were charged this phantom route, would that impact the rate of return you'd get on your build out?
Well, certainly. I mean, we build direct connects based upon, you know, what the economics of traffic delivery are, and obviously if you can't reap the economics by building a direct connection, then there would be no incentive to build a direct connection.
The there was also some testimony by Mr. Thompson that traffic studies are common practice throughout the industry. As to the CMRS carriers, do you agree that traffic studies are common?
I do not. I mean, traffic studies are common in the industry. They're much more common as it relates to the classification of traffic for local exchange carriers, because their compensation is—it's not a minute is a minute. Their compensation is best based on how you can label or classify a call. That's not true at all in the wireless business. Traffic coming into our network is a minute. It's a minute. So when we do traffic studies, our traffic studies are more focused on, do we have enough capacity? What's the right efficiency for the trunk group capacity that we have? So we do traffic studies, but they don't classify traffic. They just determine, you know, do we have an efficient route to handle the traffic that we're experiencing?
And after you, after Western merged with Alltel, was Alltel a bigger wireless company than Western?
About 8 times larger than Western.
Had Alltel ever completed a inter-MTA traffic study?
No, they hadn't.
The there's also some testimony just on cabs bills. Mr. Loss said that his company's practice with respect to credits is not to provide interest on his cabs bills. Do you agree that would be an appropriate practice in this situation?
Well, I don't, and in fact, we receive a number of cabs bills. Quest is a good example that have retroactive adjustments to those bills because of usually some regulatory decision that we weren't a party to, you know, the approach that is taken is, Denny is right in the sense that Quest puts a credit on the bill, but it also that credit is inclusive of interest for any cash we would have paid on erroneously or prior billed traffic that was billed at a rate that was higher than what we would have paid. So, for example, if it took 10 months for a final decision to get rendered in some Quest tariff matter, and that decision ended up providing us a credit. Quest would provide that credit as well as interest back to the date that that would have been effective.
There's also some testimony by Mr. Law regarding transiting. Do you agree with Mr. Law that there's not been a transiting agreement between WWC and Golden West since January 1st of 2003?
Right.
Golden West ever approach you about putting in place a transiting agreement?
No, they have not.
There has been some discussion and some questions to Mr. Law on the affiliated on these affiliated companies. What's been the experience with WWC's experience with paying transiting to affiliated companies for transiting to one of their affiliates?
Well, typically we don't when we're dealing with affiliated entities who have, you know, kind of a shared network infrastructure, and they all do, or if they don't, you know, the existence of two affiliated entities that operate contiguously, you know, generally we negotiate an agreement that if they do provide a transit service, transit's only paid on traffic to non-affiliated parties.
And is there a reason that paying an affiliated party transiting can be counterproductive?
Well, yeah. I mean, if you're an affiliate and you operate different legal entities, I mean, it is possible to game the system and implement routing conventions that result in more revenue that moves from one pocket to the other of your affiliate.
I recall that Mr. Law testified that Golden West does not charge Quest for transiting. Do you recall that?
That's correct.
And
I would also say that Mr. Law testified that they don't charge their affiliate for transiting traffic. In this case, it would be Golden West transiting traffic through Vivian's Custer exchange to be delivered to Western Wireless at that exchange. There's some of the Golden West exchanges are in the EAS area around EAS, have EAS with Custer. Western Wireless has telephone numbers in Custer, and Golden West, as well as Vivian, deliver traffic to Western Wireless at Western Wireless's Vivian interconnection point with Custer. And so, therefore, Golden West is transiting traffic across Custer to be delivered to Western Wireless. There's no charges for that, per Mr. Law's testimony.
Does WWC charge, or does WWC transit traffic for Golden West or any of the Golden West companies?
Well, in fact, we do, and we don't like it. But it has to do with the fact that the Ruralex here in Golden West haven't implemented number portability. So when we get calls to our telephone numbers that had previously been assigned to us that were ported in most cases to Verizon, that traffic is delivered to us by Golden West because they don't do the number portability routing. They don't handle their number portability routing responsibility. We are then obligated to do not only transit that traffic, but we have to do a database dip to determine where that traffic is destined to, and then we incur the cost for the dip, and then we reroute the traffic for delivery to the other carrier. So, it's a transit function manifested by the fact that Golden West doesn't uphold its N-1 routing responsibilities as an LNP carrier.
And are you charging them for that transiting?
We have requested terms and conditions for that, and they did not respond.
The now, Mr. Bauer testified by from Kennebec. You recall that?
Yes.
there was a marked as Golden West 43, a letter resetting, unilaterally resetting the rates to SS7. You recall that?
Yes.
I believe Mr. Bauer was offered to show that you were paying some of those reset rates. Had it been your intent that Kennebec's unilaterally adjusted rates would be paid?
No, it was not. In fact, when this issue came up, it was in roughly of June of 05, I was asked by our telco accounting department if this was a legitimate change in billing practice, and I told them no, that we should continue to pay at the default rate, but that we hadn't agreed to new inter-MTA factors, and so to dispute the incremental charges associated with those. It's my understanding they did dispute it for a couple months, and then in the translation of or the merger of that billing group into Altel, the dispute basis wasn't conferred to Altel, and so Altel began paying the claims.
Okay. But you didn't, that was not an attempt to waive any objection to those higher rates, was it?
Not at all. As soon as we get some space from this, and Mr. Bauer will be receiving some attention.
The Mr. Coyd asked Mr. Wilson some questions on unified rates. What's a unified rate?
I think of a unified rate as a single rate for, in this context, all minutes of use. A minute is a minute on your network, and the same rate applies no matter where the minute comes from or what kind of carrier it comes from, that kind of thing.
The do you use unified, has WWC used unified rates dealing with inter-MTA?
Yes, we have. A lot of our agreements don't specify a unique rate for inter-MTA traffic. In fact, the old agreements in South Dakota didn't specify any unique treatment of inter-MTA traffic. And we have that condition in many agreements throughout the country. In other instances, in Kansas in particular, inter-MTA traffic is rated at the same rate as reciprocal compensation traffic or intra-MTA traffic.
Okay, I'm going to mark an additional exhibit, Exhibit 21. I'm going to show you what's been marked as WWC Exhibit 21. Can you identify what that is for the commission, please?
Yes, this is a corrected version of our refund request that was entered previously. There were a couple of, in my last cross-examination, there were a couple of issues raised, and what I've done is corrected for those issues in this version.
Those were some, can you explain briefly what those corrections were?
Yes. For all of the companies, what I did in order to make reconciliation easier for everybody was I went back to the first January of 03 billing on here, and I adjusted those to a proration number that is equal to the proration of usage from the actual January 1st date to the date of the bill.
The bill covered part of the bill was for traffic delivered prior to January 1st, 2003.
Correct. And so to make it easier for everybody, this version, I believe, trues up to the identical proration that Golden West used for that month of traffic. So the minutes are the same for that particular time period. So that affected all of the spreadsheets and is part of the reason for the adjusted totals here. There were some, based on Ms. Weiss' cross-examination, there were some other specific errors that she identified in the previous set, and these related to payments that had not been incorporated in that prior set. There is payments for on the Bridgewater spreadsheet that weren't previously recorded are now included. Payments, a payment for made in January 06 on the Kadoka agreement is included, and a payment in January 06 on the Sioux Valley agreement is included. And then finally, there was one other adjustment having to do with the application of the balance of traffic factor in the Sioux Valley agreement that I had inadvertently continued the 2004 factor, and what I've done is adjusted that to reflect the appropriate 2005 factor for June of 05 through December of 05.
When you talk about factor, you're talking about exchange traffic factor, correct?
Exchange traffic for intra-MTA minutes.
For intra-MTA?
Right.
Okay. And that then, the first page again is a summary of the totals and gives a grand total as of December 31st, 2005. Is that correct?
Right. It represented a modest change, actually, I believe a modest decrease from the previous number.
I'd move for admission of WWC 21.
No objection.
No objection.
Admitted.
Mr. Smith, if I could take 5 minutes and just go through my notes, I think I'm about done. And
yeah. Why don't we take a 10-minute recess? That's right. I need to get some. Okay, we're back in session after our recess. Did you have any further questions, Mr. Wysorek, at this time?
Turning your attention back to Exhibit 21, if you could open that up to the columns and the pages that actually do the calculations. You've eliminated a couple of the columns in this spreadsheet versus the last one. Is that correct?
Right. Columns B, C, and D appeared in the last spreadsheet. They were referential information only that didn't really have any impact on the calculations. And so for simplification purposes, I've hidden those spreadsheets from this view, but in the electronic documents we filed, that information is still there.
Yeah, and if I move for admission of 21, with commission's permission, I'll submit that in electronic format, this exhibit in electronic format. I submitted the original just so people could see the formulas for if they had questions on it today. And unless somebody has an objection with that, I'll submit this one in electronic format also.
Thank you. That would be helpful.
As to the actual formulas, except for where you change the traffic exchange factor, are the formulas the same then in these spreadsheets?
Yes.
So if one goes to look in the actual cells as laid out in the electronic, those formulas would be the same except for those where you had the wrong traffic exchange factor.
That's correct. Okay.
That's all I have at this time.
Thank you. At this point,
do you want to, does Golden West want to proceed with cross-examination of Ron, or do you want to deal with Mr. Music, the issue of him?
At this point, it would be Golden West's preference to take the rebuttal testimony of Roger Music and then do the cross-examination after out of order, so to speak.
Okay. Well, that could occur tomorrow morning, too, as I understand it. Did you? Is there any further discussion about? You're excused for now, then, Ron. Thank you. Do the parties have any further discussion concerning Mr. Music and the objection that's been raised?
And I'd like to make a formal objection for the record on it. As way of background. It was, I believe, last Wednesday we received a fax that Mr. Music would testify. I responded and pointed out that there's an outstanding interrogatory if there's going to be any expert testimony, and that needs to be responded to. Approximately 5:30 Central, 4:30 Mountain, I received a response laying out that he would be acting as an expert witness, essentially testifying regarding, generally, I understand the testimony to be regarding switches. As an expert witness, it's not as if we haven't known throughout that there's issues with, there's a difference of opinion as to how hard or what's going on with the switches. This commission might recall that last August there was a lengthy discussion as continuing this because there was questions about how the switches were interchanging and what information we were able to get off the switches. If they're going to have somebody come in and testify about switches, they should have disclosed them and picked an expert at that time. He is coming now at a time where the individual who worked with the switches to pull this data is not available to me. And I believe it's an untimely designation of an expert, we had been discussing switches and the difficulty with pulling information from switches for months and months and months before the hearing last March. And he wasn't disclosed until just a couple of days ago. His general contents of his testimony wasn't disclosed until after close of business on Friday, at least in Central Time. I'd also point the commission to two South Dakota Supreme Court cases. One is Schrader, S-C-H-R-A-D. ER 522 Northwest 2nd 205, where the court looked at whether a late disclosed expert should be allowed. In that case, they allowed it, but only because there was information that nobody knew was going to come up. It came up at the last second. There was some questions whether the court acknowledged that if this should have been information that should have came in the case in chief, the expert should have been disclosed earlier. But because this was brand new information late, that was allowed. And also, I point the commission to Supreme Court case of Thompson at 698 Northwest 2nd 512, where the Supreme Court upheld the denial of a late disclosed expert, where there's there should have been plenty of time and information that the expert was needed during the process of discovery, and they should have been disclosed at that time. I would contend that Mr. Music's testimony, if he's going to talk about switches, obviously we all know that this was about switches. That's not something new. It's 6-8 months old, and to have him come in as a rebuttal expert and offer testimony on switching is inappropriate and prejudicial to WWC at this time.
Thank you. Ms. Rogers, do you have a response?
Yes, thank you. We would urge the commission to allow the rebuttal testimony of Roger Music. I would first of all point out that there was no pre-filed testimony in this case, so there was no way that we would have known exactly what points Mr. Wilson was going to cover in his testimony, and we didn't, in fact, anticipate and could not have reasonably anticipated everything that Mr. Wilson did testify to, and then some of the things that Mr. Williams has testified to in their testimony. Some of the rebuttal points that we believe need to be addressed here that we did not or were not able to anticipate was the whole issue of what is CDR data, versus AMA data versus call detail records, and there was just a lot of confusion over that whole point during the case in chief. I don't think that there was any way to anticipate that. Also, the process, the exact process for obtaining CDR data is another thing that we would like to call Mr. Music for. What data is included in the raw CDR data? There was a lot of testimony and confusion over that. We believe that that's something that needs to be addressed by this witness. And how difficult is it to obtain the raw CDR data? Disk storage requirements also came up during Mr. Wilson's testimony. Disk storage requirements for raw data versus mined data. That also is something that we did not anticipate on the case in chief. And the difficulties that may arise in the post-processing of CDR data. What are the industry uses of CDR data and data generation capabilities of wireline versus wireless switches is also something that we did not anticipate. And then also the issue of inter-machine trunking was not something that had come out or been disclosed previously. So for all of the foregoing reasons and the fact that we were not able to anticipate every point Mr. Wilson made, and also because there was not the opportunity for pre-filed testimony, we would ask that this evidence be allowed.
Yeah, I'd like to make just some brief comments. I concur in Ms. Rogers' comments. And I would also say that the comment on the part of Mr. Wazorek that Mr. Music intends to testify about switching is certainly an overgeneralization of what he intends to testify to. You know, in addition to there being no pre-filed testimony in this case, Mike Wilson did not file any sort of an expert report, anything along that line. So we certainly were not in a position to anticipate with respect to everything that he was going to testify to. I think there's quite a list if you go through Mr. Wilson's testimony as to, you know, certain things that Mr. Music can testify to in rebuttal. Ms. Rogers mentioned those. You know, just the process for obtaining CDR data, difficulties that may arise in post-processing of CDR data, uses of CDR data, what data is included in raw CDR data, how difficult is it to pull raw CDR data, disk storage space, data generation capabilities of wireline versus wireless switches. And then with respect to the issues of inter-machine trunking, my take on the testimony that's been submitted by Western Wireless on inter-machine trunking, it appears that they're putting forth this fact that that you know they have converted things to inter-machine trunking over this period of time is making it more difficult for them to obtain the data that was necessary in order to do an analysis of the inter-MTA proposals. The other thing that they're indicating has made it more difficult to get things done is switched cell site deployments, things such as that. They're very clearly putting up kind of as a defense the to not being able to provide all of this data maybe as timely as we would have liked it, putting up as a defense changes in their network. And Mr. Music is in a position to testify to those sorts of claims. So very clearly, we believe his testimony is necessary for us to reasonably rebut the claims that have been offered. You know, the basic thing here, I think, is that the commission is in a position to confine his testimony. He's being called as a rebuttal witness. If he gets into areas that he shouldn't get into that are outside the scope of the rebuttal, I think the commission can limit his testimony. So rather than denying him as a witness or rejecting him as a witness, I think that you know the commission is in a position to take what action it needs to make sure that he doesn't go beyond its scope. And with that, we would respectfully request that he be allowed to testify today.
Ms. Weiss, do you have want to weigh in on this?
Staff is not objecting to the witness.
No response, Mr. Weiss.
I'd make the following response. in the record, as part of Exhibit 14, is an email from Mike Wilson to Larry Thompson. And that email says, thanks for your continued patience on this project. As you can guess, it's been quite an ordeal trying to obtain the related data. WWC has not historically had access to call data records for the use of reporting. We have had a year-long project to build out a tool to allow access to this level of data. The tool is still in the beta stage, and we're pretty far away from real-time access to this data. The data extraction requires many resources and much server time, not to mention hard disk space. Given the complexities and resources required, I've requested our analysts supply a subset of what is needed so we can get our hands on the CDR tool. Ms. Rogers just said that they had absolutely no idea that we are going to claim that it was difficult to pull this data, or that we had hard disk space restrictions, or we're having trouble with this. I mean, she has just walked down this email and said that's exactly what this man's going to testify to. This is an email that was took place in November 2004, before this action was even filed. To let them bring in an expert at this time now, when this should have been their case in chief, they're essentially arguing that we're in bad faith. This should be part of their case in chief. And now they're just trying to bring it in at the end when we don't get a chance to respond to it.
Commissioners, do you have any questions or? I guess one question I have is, even the hearing before you guys was on March 10th is when we recessed. Why does this, I mean, it just puts us in a bad spot here. You know, I didn't even know this. We didn't know this problem even existed. We could have ruled on this last week, and then Mr. Wieczorek would have had a chance to prepare some kind of responsive approach to it.
Good. Just a minute.
Okay. Ms. Rogers.
Thank you. I would just, again, reiterate a couple of points. First of all, under the rules of evidence, I do not believe that we are entitled to disclose rebuttal witnesses. We did so because we wanted to bring the issue up front. Mr. Wieczorek then contacted me and said, well, you have to, because of this outstanding discovery request, you have to qualify him as an expert. We discussed it a little bit, and we went ahead and did that. So I believe that we have fulfilled all the requirements of the rules. I would, again, reiterate that because there is no pre-file testimony in this case, it isn't possible to anticipate every single thing that's going to come up in this testimony. And just because there are things that appear in discovery That does not mean that we can anticipate that those are things that are for sure going to be testified to during the hearing. I think that we have a right to try to impeach the credibility of their witnesses, and that in the rebuttal process, and that's what we're doing here. And so we believe that this is proper evidence and it should be included. You can give the evidence the weight that you deem is appropriate, but we believe that it is appropriate to admit the evidence at this time and allow the testimony.
Ms. Rogers, why couldn't we have had this proceeding a week ago or 2 weeks ago and have had this ironed out before we got here? I mean, I haven't looked at these cases. I, you know, had not a clue that we'd have something like this here.
Quite frankly, after we got the transcript of the hearing, we needed to go over it ourselves and review it and then decide among ourselves, is this something that we believe is necessary to pursue? One other rebuttal issue that we want to rebut in this case is on the contamination of the data. I believe I failed to mention that. As soon as we had the opportunity to review the transcript and decide among ourselves whether this was a rebuttal witness that we thought would be helpful to our case, then that's when we did the notice and proceeded.
Thank you. Commissioners,
Tal, could you read that email that you were referring to, that you referenced earlier? Not in its entirety, but the appropriate parts and the date of it again?
The email is part of the string, part of Exhibit 14, is string number 10. The date of the email is Friday, November 5th, 2004. Essentially, the email talks about WWC not historically having access to call data records used for the use of reporting. It talks about how they've had a year-long project trying to build a tool to have access of this level of data. It talks about, this is to the predecessor project that Mr. Wilson testified, you might recall that. It talks about the data extraction required many resources and much server time, not to mention hard disk space. And essentially, all but the intermachine trunking are the issues that Ms. Rogers just mentioned, saying they had absolutely no idea might be part of this hearing. The intermachine trunking was discussed at length last summer and also in a meeting last September between the parties and staff as to some of the issues with extracting the data. So to claim surprise, I think, is not genuine at this point.
Thank you.
Mr. Smith, if it was appropriate, I wanted to pick Ms. Weiss' brain a little bit more. Staff has no objection. You're probably trying to stay out of the fray, but yes. Could you elaborate a little bit, commenting on why staff has no objection?
Generally, I think it's really within your discretion whether to exclude him or not. But generally, exclusion of a witness is considered to be something of a last resort, I guess. I mean, I understand the point that I think he could have been identified earlier in the process, but we didn't have a deadline for when expert witnesses were supposed to be identified, I believe. So, yeah, I believe it's a close question. And I would agree with Mr. Wysorek that a number of the things that they did mention probably could have been anticipated, because a lot of that did come out in discovery, what they want him to respond to.
Thank you.
One of the things that we often deal with is situations where we have pre-filed testimony. I think if this were that situation, I would feel a little bit more strongly about looking at excluding. At the same time, I think that if we can limit Mr. Musak's testimony, focus on the rebuttal-type issue, you know, in my mind, the fairness probably cuts that way. Now, the one thing I would say about that, though, is that Mr. Wysorek did receive late notice about this, and I don't know if there's the ability to allow him to file rebuttal testimony to Mr. Muzak's testimony, even possibly do a post-hearing type thing. I mean, and with all due respect, I mean, I think to a certain extent, you put yourself in that situation where I think there might be a fairness issue about whether or not he should be able to file something. And I'm just curious, Ms. Rogers, if he could stick to that. I mean, if he gets something that comes up out of left field, I mean, should he not have the opportunity to be able to respond to that in some way, shape, or form? Because I don't think it's going to be a great harm, and I think probably it's an opportunity to get some more information that could be helpful to the commission. So my inclination is to let Mr. Muzak testify. At the same time, if he starts, after the fact, tearing apart a case that probably everyone is expecting was going to be wrapped up in the first week of hearing, then I think there is perhaps a fairness issue that starts coming the other way. I mean, would you be willing to allow some type of limited post-file testimony or rebuttal?
The only reason I hesitate here is I'm trying to figure out, we're on rebuttal, and I assume you're talking about like some type of sur rebuttal that
I think it would be sur rebuttal or whatever we call it. It would be his opportunity to, analyze and go after, so to speak, Mr. Muzak's testimony.
I would point out that Mr. Williams is still here and part of this hearing and seems to have as much knowledge concerning their switching and some of these issues. And so I would think that Mr. Wieczorek could certainly counter anything that is raised here through Mr. Williams's sur rebuttal testimony, because he will have another shot at it. To the extent that that Mr. Wieczorek would feel a compelling need to try to get some response from Mr. Wilson, I think that we would probably not object to some type of late filed response just to the points raised here.
And that's probably a good point. I mean, he does have Mr. Williams here, so there may be opportunity, especially if we get Mr. Muzak's testimony done today and this evening, opportunity tomorrow to address the issues, that maybe this whole thing will be closed. I guess if I go ahead and say it's okay for Mr. Muzak to testify, though, I would like to leave the opportunity open for Mr. Wieczorek, if he cannot get it all done through Mr. Williams, to at least have be able to make the case to bring in something else, just because of the late nature of this witness coming to before the commission.
And, like I said, we would agree to that, not beyond what would ordinarily be allowed if Mr. Wilson was, still involved and available in this case.
Do you want to vote, commissioners, or should I just rule? Okay. Well, I'm going to let him testify then, so you can overrule me. Objection overruled. Not without some concern on my part, though, and I do think when we had 5 weeks here that you guys maybe could have come forward a little sooner, but go ahead, Roger, take the stand.
Please tell me where the testimony about giving this clause within the truth of all truth and nothing but the truth will help you guys.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Would you please state your name and address for the record?
Roger D. Muzak, 165 South Harmon Drive, Mitchell, South Dakota.
Could you briefly explain or give the commission your educational background?
Graduated from South Dakota School of Mines and Technology as an electrical engineer in 1971.
And do you have any post-educational training after that?
I'm a professional electrical engineer registered in today South Dakota, but have been registered in 15 to 25 states over my career.
What is your employment history?
First, I was an employee of Martin & Associates starting in 71, became a partner with two other people, an equal partner in 74, worked at Martin & Associates until we sold it in 1999, and I stayed until the year 2000, and I've been the CEO of Innovative Systems since 2000. While at Martin & Associates, I spent the first 15 years doing strictly engineering work for telephone switchboards, networks, large networks for telephone companies. Then started the OSS, or Operational Support Systems Division of Martin & Associates, in about 1979 or 80. And we wrote software for the industry. We wrote software for CLEX, IXCs, wireless carriers, and landline carriers, and CEA providers all over the United States. Sold probably 200 systems in total.
You probably answered this question, but I will ask it anyway. I was going to ask you if you have any experience with wireless companies.
Yes, I do. We've built many billing systems for wireless companies and call processing systems for wireless companies.
And what about with wireline companies? Do you have experiences with them?
Yes, I do. We've dealt with many wireline companies, hundreds.
And the same with you have experience with centralized equal access?
Yes, I do. Basically, I conceived the idea of the centralized equal access in Iowa, did the regulatory work and the design of the Iowa network services, the engineering regulatory work. Don't want to take over for the lawyers. And testified at the FCC, the Iowa Commission, also did the regulatory engineering side for the Minnesota Equal Access Network. And one of my partners, Doug Martin, did the regulatory side of the engineering work for South Dakota.
That would be for SDN?
SDN networks, yes.
Do you have any experience with either wireless or wireline Lucent switches?
Both on the wireline and wireless side, we've had numerous companies that have had Lucent switches over the years, and some still do.
And would the same be true with both wireless and or wireline Nortel switches?
Yes. Again, we've done a lot of work with wireline and wireless Nortel switches. I'm also a business partner of Nortel and develop software jointly with Nortel for the industry.
Do you have any experience in processing call detail records for end-user or inter-carrier billing purposes?
Yes, I do, both on the wireline and wireless side. We've done that since about 1980. From the smallest independent telephone companies, and our largest client we had was AT&T, where we did their billing and software for them.
With regard to services that you have provided to wireline companies, have you been involved in traffic studies to determine the jurisdiction of traffic?
Yes, I have. From the very beginning of the cost separation studies, I developed our first computer programs to do cost separation studies, traffic studies to basically jurisdictionalize the traffic in those days, typically between local, state, and interstate. And probably have done thousands of separation studies in my career.
Were you present when Mr. Williams testified in this case?
Yes, I was.
And have you also reviewed the testimony of Mike Wilson as presented in the March 8th through 10th?
Yes, I did.
I would point out, first of all, that there was testimony, I believe, today by Mr. Williams and also by Mr. Wilson, that there are significant differences between wireless versus wireline switches. And I would ask you to please address that point.
Well, both the Nortel and the Lucent wireless switches are both basically minor modifications of their wireline switches. The Lucent or the Nortel switch used to be able to be a wireless and a wireline switch at the same time until a couple of years ago. But they're very similar in hardware. The CDR record format is slightly different. A lot of the software is the same within the switches.
Mr. Music, I'm going to hand you what has been marked as Golden West Exhibit 49. Can you please identify this?
Oh, okay. What's this one? Yep. Yes, this is a page out of the Nortel manual that was, I believe, furnished as part of the interrogatories in this case by Western Wireless. It's basically a drawing that shows how the DMS switchboard or MTX switchboard, which is a Nortel terminology, takes the call records, run it through their AMMA subsystem, and then they have basically three different methods of getting those AMMA call records out of the switch. The three at the bottom are the tape, disks, or SLM system.
Is this part of a standard manual for a Nortel switch?
I believe so. It was the manual furnished by Western Wireless, and it looks to me like every other Nortel manual that I've seen.
Regardless of whether the switch is a wireless or a wireline switch?
There would be different manuals for the wireline and wireless, but this AMMA collection and methods of distribution of the AMMA are the same in the wireline and wireless Nortel switch.
I'm also going to ask you to identify what has been marked as Golden West 48.
Yes, this is a page out of the Lucent manual that was furnished by Western Wireless in this case, I believe, again, through interrogatories. And it's the page that in the Lucent switch does a very similar architectural drawing of how the AMMA records come out of a Lucent switch.
And, again, that would this be a standard manual as you recognize it for a Lucent switch?
I believe it is. It's labeled Lucent Technologies, and I believe it's a standard Lucent manual.
At this time, we would offer Golden West 48 and 49.
Just subject to the my continuing objection to all of his testimony, I don't have an objection as to any objection beyond that.
No objection.
48 and 49 are admitted.
So, returning to my original question, what are the differences between wireless versus wireline switches?
The primary difference as it relates to the AMMA records, which I think is the subject that we're talking about here, is primarily the fact that in the wireless switch there would be a few different fields included in the AMMA record, things like the cell site that the call began at, those kinds of things, where in the wireless switch there may be more information about IXC type, you know, who the connecting carrier is. So some of the fields would be different. The vast majority of the information would be the same, though, because the important information is the start time of the call, the date and time the call started, how long the person talked, whether the call was completed or not, the from phone number, the terminating phone number. That's the major portions of the call record that are used. The trunk group that the call was processed over would normally be part of the call record.
There was also some discrepancy in Mr. Wilson's testimony among the terms used for the data. CDRs, AMA, extracted CDRs, call detail records. Could you please attempt to clarify some of those discrepancies?
I'm going to object to the extent she's categorized those as discrepancies. I think he defined those terms as he was using them, but they're not discrepancies.
I'm going to sustain that.
Let me approach it a different way, sure. If I might. I would like to show you what has been marked as Golden West Exhibit
47,
yes. Can you generally describe what that exhibit is?
Yep.
Yes.
Can I stand up?
Can you just give me a general description of what that exhibit depicts?
The switching system, whether it's a Lucent or a Nortel, when a call is placed and when the call is completed, it will typically write an AMA record, and that record will have the start time, duration, calling and called number, cell site, and it will be written in the CDR, typically in an AMA format. So I'm going to refer to the CDR, and people, that abbreviate is call detail record, but it's in a special format determined by the switch. So this is a AMA formatted CDR record. Typically that CDR record, or actually in every case I know of, the process is that CDR record is moved from the switch in the format that the switch collects it in into the data processing center. And the data processing center then has the raw switch CDR record in an AMA format. Then the process is,
and we'll
continue.
We'll go through the process
okay.
in a minute. So generally speaking, then, this diagram identifies the data and then describes the process for extracting the inner MTA, well, or the CDRs or the data. Is that correct?
Yes.
Did you develop this diagram?
Yes, I did.
And I would offer Golden West Exhibit 47.
Just subject to my continuing objection on his testimony.
No objection.
No objection.
Admitted.
Now, you have, I think, started to at least clarify the CDR versus AMA terminology. And would you now tell us what this diagram depicts with regard to extracting that data from the switch?
Okay. Well, first off, again, these two CDR slash AMA, that is the format that the switch creates the call record in. So there's been no processing other than the information moved from the switch to the data processing center. This could also be referred to as raw switch data, I think, someplace in the testimony. Once that has arrived at a data processing center, and by the way, this is the only call record that the switch has, and it's used for all purposes. It's used for billing the customers, trunk analysis studies, any purpose that you would want to use call records for. This is the call record that's used for that purpose. The next thing that would happen in a data processing center is typically it would run through some kind of a process or a preprocessor that would basically convert the data in this format to tables that would go into a database.
And I believe there was testimony from Mr. Wilson concerning those tables.
Yes, he testified that, you know, they had taken the CDR data and processed it into a database, a relational database. And typically this would be basically similar information that is here. It's just been reformatted. It may have the, say, the name of the city where it comes from added to it in this pre-processing process, and it may change in format slightly from here to here, but the substance of the call record really does not change. Typically there's one call record up here, there's one call record down here, the start time, the from number, the to number, the duration are all the same. Usually the preprocessor adds some additional information that it gets from other tables. Name of the town, maybe the distance involved, those kinds of things. The call detail database, this is a relational database, and that's really key here. The concept that pretty much everybody uses today, and Mr. Wilson testified that Altel uses, is to take these AMA records, put them in a relational database. And the whole purpose of a relational database is to make it easy to report on. That's why relational databases were developed 15, 20 years ago. This table here, do you want me to go into
Yes,
it?
Please.
Okay.
Explain the cell site ID table.
Basically, another table that would be in the database that is necessary to create the extracted call records that we're looking for. So this is a table that would be entered typically by Altel. where they have the cell site ID table, and it includes the MTA and the state of where that cell site is located. So if they have 200 cell sites, there would be 200 entries in this table, and each cell site would have an ID number, and that ID number is one of the fields in this record here. So in this record, we know the ID of the cell site. This tells us where the cell site is located. And it's not really important that we know exactly where it's located. It's just important that we know what state it's in and what MTA it is. How important the location is. We don't need to know which side of the road it's on or anything like that. We need to know which MTA and which state. So once we have this database table with the call records in them and this table with the cell site ID, then we can take these two tables and write a database query that basically takes this information, takes the cell site ID, looks it up in this table, and says what MTA is that located in and what state is it located in, and adds that to the call record and creates the extracted call information. And this is the type of information that has been furnished to VPS throughout this process, the 2004, and I think they furnished it again in 2005.
The database query process, is that a SQL database?
Yeah. These would be relational. This would be typically a relational database with different tables, and the way you get data out of a database is by writing a SQL query on that database. So you would specify which NPA and NNXs you're looking for, which MTAs you're looking for. It's a very standard in the industry. There's an industry standard SQL language that pretty much works with all databases that has been around for about 15 years. Most of you on your PCs have it available, you know, through an Access database. Very similar to that, this would obviously be a larger version of your Access database, but the same concepts.
You heard either today or read a lot of testimony about VPS requesting call detail records from WWC. Is there more than one way that provisioning of those CDRs could have been accomplished by WWC?
WWC could go through this process and furnish what I refer to as the extracted CDRs with MTA and state data added to them. So they've effectively done the preprocessor, and they've done the database query, and these are the types of files that they chose to provide. I think Larry asked multiple times if he could get the raw switch data, and then if he would have been furnished this data, VPS would have done this process and put in the time and effort to make that happen. But they could have furnished this. This is typically a file that's collected either in real time or every day, because it's the same file you need to bill every customer in your wireless network.
What about the volume of the data?
Okay. The testimony that I've heard indicates that in order to have a complete set of data, we would have to have the CDRs from four switches, or we would have to have the extraction from the multiple CDR records that have been processed from the four switches. In today's technology, that's not much more than a laptop. We write software that does this all the time. We're testing our products at 2 million calls an hour, which is way more volume than Western Wireless would have in their network.
So even if Western Wireless would have chosen to produce or provide the raw CDRs, that still would have been doable, even considering the volume of the data.
Definitely. They're collecting this file typically either in real time or at the most once a day from every switch. If they would have chosen to provide this file, basically VPS would have had to do this function. They would have taken the cell site IDs and the table that they received in the discovery process and populated a table like this, and they would have done their own preprocessor, created this database and then did their own query and provided those records.
So had Western Wireless produced the raw call detail records, they still would have needed to receive the cell site ID table with the MTA and state, well, or at least the cell site ID table from Western Wireless.
To be 100% correct, I believe they would have had to get this from Western Wireless. I think they could probably have been about 98% correct just by looking at the call records and saying, well, calls from this cell site come from this NPA and an X. And you could look at that NPA and an X, and let's say it was an Aberdeen NPA and an X. Well, it's very easy to look at that and say, well, this cell site must have been in the MTA that Aberdeen is in, because 99% of the calls come from phone numbers that are around Aberdeen. So when you get right on the border and you have a cell site that maybe provided phone numbers on both sides of an MTA, those would have been hard to do without information from Western Wireless, but it would have been a very, very small percentage of them.
There was some testimony provided by Mr. Wilson concerning disk storage requirements.
Mm-hmm.
Do you believe that that is an issue in this type of situation?
I don't believe it is.
And why is that?
Oh, because a 500 gigabyte disk drive today is about this big and about this high, and would probably hold months worth of Western Wireless data from those four switches and costs about $400.
I want to talk a little bit about the process on the right-hand side of that chart. And again, there was a lot of testimony that to process the raw data and follow the aerials and come down to the final result of the extracted CDRs with MTA and state data is a very prolonged and excruciating process. And I'm wondering if you could comment on that.
I was kind of shocked with that testimony, because the whole purpose of relational databases is to make that extraction of data easy and so it doesn't take very much time or is not very difficult. In today's world, lots of high school kids can write these queries and are querying database on a routine basis. Probably some of you guys are writing SQL queries against Access databases, and it's just not hard in today's world.
Do you have people on your staff, for example, that would be able to do that?
I would expect every one of my programming staff could do that in their sleep. Probably 5 or 6, maybe 10 of my support staff that have business degrees would be writing SQL queries on a routine basis.
And why do companies do this?
Well, because it's the relational databases are the easiest way to put data in a standard format that can be extracted for special purposes later, which is kind of what this study is all about, a special extraction of the data.
If a carrier such as Western Wireless did not have anybody on staff that could write the appropriate queries, are there firms besides yours that are available to contract for those services?
Yeah, there's thousands of firms in the United States, or maybe hundreds of thousands of firms that do SQL queries every day. There's probably hundreds that do it as it relates to AMA records on a daily basis. Very, very common.
On the left-hand side of that exhibit, if you changed the word wireless switch to wireline switch, how would that affect this process?
This preprocessor has to match up on kind of the input side with the format of these call records. So the call records would change slightly, therefore you would have a different, slightly modified preprocessor based on a wireline or a wireless switch. In my business, we've probably written 50, 75 different preprocessors, because in the old IXC days, every IXC switch had its own preprocessor. It's kind of been standardized today to a few standard formats, so you don't need to have as many of them today. But it's a pretty simple matter to write the preprocessor to match the CDR record format.
But other than the preprocessor, the basic methodology would be the same, I assume, with the exception of the cell site ID.
That's exactly right. On the wireline side, you would not have the cell site, so that wouldn't be included in these call detail records, and you wouldn't be matching to a cell site in this other table, typically.
But other than that, the basic process for extracting the raw data from the CDRs is the same for wireless versus wireline carrier?
Yes.
There was some testimony concerning whether or not once the tools are in place, is it difficult to run the data for another company. Can you respond to that?
Sure. The preprocessor would stay the same from as long as the CDR format didn't change. And Nortel would not be changing that maybe once every few years, but not very often. So the preprocessor would stay the same for multiple years. The cell site table would have, if you added 10 cell sites, it would have 10 additional entries in it to explain which MTA and which state each cell site is in. The query that you're doing, if you wrote this query kind of as a general purpose query in the first place, it would already take into account all of those new cell sites, and you probably wouldn't even have to change this query. But if you did, it's just a few minutes to change the query.
So you would basically agree with the premise that once the tool is developed, that would certainly make the process for extracting these CDRs for another company much easier?
I think it's easy the first time, but it would be easier the second and third time, yes.
There was also testimony that because of changes to the wireless network of WWC, that would affect the process depicted on this exhibit. I will break those down a little bit for you, but do you have a general response to that line of testimony?
As the network is changing, clearly the results that you would get from this extracted data may change, because every time you change the network, your CDR records may change. But if you add trunks, if you change the trunking of it, the CDR records are going to reflect that change. If they didn't, you know, how are you ever going to get your billing correct every day? Because you'll never be able to keep up with all these changes in the billing world, which I got to, you know, any company has to send out end-user billing records all the time. So as the network evolves, the CDRs will change to match how the network is, because every time a call is processed, they look at how that call was processed, and that's what's included in the CDR record. So I would say the results may change over here, but the process is going to stay the same. And, you know, as I say, your numbers could change, but the process will stay the same.
One of the changes in the network, the wireless network that was discussed in testimony, I believe, by Mr. Wilson and also by Mr. Williams, perhaps, was the development of inter-machine trunking solutions. And I would ask you, first of all, could you just identify for the commission what an inter-machine trunking solution is? And I would, to aid you, ask you to identify Golden West Exhibits 45 and also 46.
Sure.
In whichever order you wish.
Yeah, let's put 46 up first. These are two drawings that I prepared to help clarify the entire issue of intermachine trunking. No, the other one, Larry. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. No.
This is 46, at least the way they're marked here. Okay. You ready?
Yes.
Okay. this is a drawing that I prepared kind of based on the testimony that I've heard from Western Wireless of how their network was and how it has migrated. In this drawing, it basically shows two wireless switches, switches 1 and 2, in different MTAs. So when they route traffic from switch 2 over to a end office that is in the MTA to the left, they hand that traffic off to an IXC. The IXC would route the call back through SDN, and it would go to the end office. So this is the normal way, at least the testimony I've heard from Western Wireless, when this all started back in 2002 or 3, that they would have been routing traffic. The key here is this call that is routed from here to here goes down through here. It's an IXC charge, so there's an access charge on that call as a interstate or intrastate call, depending on what jurisdiction it is. But there's an access charge paid for completion of that call, like there would be for any interstate or intrastate call.
We need to clarify the numbers on these exhibits. The one that you have up on the board now
is 46, based on the number that's on it.
I have mine backwards, so okay. The one that says no IMT is 46?
That's correct. The one that says no IMT at the top is 46.
And the one that says, the one we're going to discuss next is 45.
That's correct.
Now, can you then explain how or what happens when you add an intermachine trunking solution?
In this case, Western Wireless has put in some intermachine trunks between switch 1 and 2. So when they have a call here from this customer that is directed to this end office, instead of routing it through the IXC like they did before, they've routed it over the intermachine trunks down to the end office. And they're completing it over a trunk group here that is carrying both local and inter-MTA traffic. And I think that's the real subject matter of this hearing, is figuring out how much inter-machine traffic there was. Remember, this call used to be routed this way, and there was a state or interstate access charge applied to it. Now it's routed this way, and we have to figure out how much that interstate or state access charge should be. And that's the attempt at a factor to figure out the right amount of traffic.
An inter-MTA.
Inter-MTA. Mm-hmm. The other thing I might point out, there was some discussion about overflow traffic. So if the inter-machine trunks were busy, they may overflow some of that traffic to an IXC and route it back this way.
I would offer Golden West's Exhibits 45 and 46.
Just subject to my continuing objection to the testimony.
No objection.
GW 45 and 46 are received.
You've described what the addition of an intermachine trunking solution looks like in this diagram. Can you tell me how the addition of the intermachine trunks affects the process that you referred to on Golden West Exhibit 47.
Sure. In that exhibit, the call records are going to tell us how the call was routed, and we can look at taking that information and figuring out how much of it went basically over these intermachine trunks to the other end office.
Would the addition of intermachine trunks delay the processing that you described in Golden West Exhibit number 47?
They would change the result, but they would not delay it, should not delay it.
Because that information would be in the CDR that is in this switch.
Right.
Another area that of network evolution referred to in the testimony was the addition of a lot of cell sites. And can you comment on whether or not the addition of cell sites or how that would affect the process depicted in Golden West Exhibit 47?
Well, every time you added a cell site, you would have to go to that table that has the cell site ID, the MTA, and the state, and add one more entry to that table. So if you added 10 more cell sites, you would add 10 more entries to that table.
Okay. And again, is this a very difficult process?
No, it's very, very easy. And remember, all you have to do is figure out where the cell site is, which MTA it is located in. It's not like finding, you know, exactly its GPS coordinates.
Another dramatic change, so to speak, or a change that was testified to with regard to Western Wireless's network is they've added new technology for the cellular network, and it was referred to in Mr. Wilson's testimony as GSM.
Sure.
How would that affect delaying the process and being able to extract the inter-MTA CDRs?
Well, you may have some additional call records created by the new access technology that GSM would bring, but it really shouldn't delay the process from the standpoint, you know, as soon as they turn it up, they're going to start billing those customers, and, you know, they have to process those records every day to bill the customers.
What about launching of new markets? How would that affect the process?
Well, if they're successful in a new market, they would have additional CDR records, so the volumes would go up, but it wouldn't really affect the process at all.
Mr. Wilson also testified that Western Wireless tuned their networks and they sectorized sites by taking a cell site and focusing a signal from an omni-cell site, which is a 360-degree propagated signal, and focus it on either a community or a highway. Those are changes that were pointed out to their network. Can you comment on how, if at all, that would affect the process described in Golden West Exhibit Number 47?
Yeah, it would have no effect. When I read the document, there was an agreement between the parties that they would use the location of the cell site as the location of the customer. So it doesn't really matter if the customer is east of town or south of town or west of town. If his call goes through that cell site, that's the important factor. So sectorizing, turning antennas has nothing to do with the call records.
There was testimony presented that to agree to a study methodology, one of the considerations is technical feasibility. And I would ask you, is production of call detail records technically feasible?
Yes.
For the companies that you work with, how long would you anticipate it would take to produce call detail records?
I'm going to object as lack foundation. She hasn't elicited testimony that he's working with any companies that have a similar billing system as WWC.
Sustained.
When you say that it is technically feasible to produce the call detail records, can you explain what you mean by that?
All the companies that I work with and every company that I've ever talked to is first able to provide the raw call detail records right off the switch, kind of on a moment's notice. That's just typically a file transfer. You could FTP the files, copy them to a CD, whatever, to send that file. You don't even have to process it. If you're going to run it through your preprocessor and your extracting of the data, all the companies I'm familiar with would be able to do that, matter of a day or two.
The agreement, are you familiar with the agreement in this case, the Reciprocomp agreement that was, the effective date was January 1 of 2003 and it expired December 31 of 2005?
I have read it, yes.
The agreement requires adjustment of the initial inter-MTA factor 3 months after the executed date of the agreement. That would mean the call detail records would be, have to be provided and the analysis done within 3 months. Do you believe that's a reasonable time frame?
Very reasonable.
And why do you say that?
It would be trivial to do it easily within 3 months.
For any companies that you have worked with, do you think 19 months is a reasonable time frame to produce call detail records?
Sounds very unreasonable to me.
Are you aware of any instances where, I'm going to come back to that question. Now, the agreement also calls for an inter-MTA study for each ILEC every 6 months. Do you believe that that would be that time frame and those deadlines would be difficult to meet?
Yeah. Let me go back to Exhibit 47.
Four switches that we're talking about here create one CDR file, typically each day.
You mean the four switches of Western Wireless?
Western Wirelesses. Each one of their four switches that serve customers in South Dakota create typically one file per day for all the calls in that switch, not just ones for Vivian or Kadoka or whatever, but it's one file that has all the calls. And normally when you would pre-process this, you would be pre-processing all of those calls at one time, and they would all be going into this database. Then it's only a matter of which exchanges or companies you want to do the extract for. So you would write the SQL query here. If you wanted to pull out all of the Vivian calls, this query would have probably the Vivian NPA NNXs in it. If you wanted the Kennebec NPA NNXs, you would put a query here with the Kennebec NPA NNXs. So the main process, you're collecting all the calls, and if you do a 15-day study, you've got 15 days worth of call data. You run it through the preprocessor, and then you write a query for each telephone company, and you have basically the results for that given telephone company. Not an average, but specifically for that company.
And again, you testified that you have read the WWC agreement and specifically the portions of the agreement concerning the requirement to do studies every 6 months. Does the agreement define how the study should be done?
I thought the agreement was very clear that it would be based on the cell site tower location and it would be based on the switch location where the call is terminated. The only thing that I don't think was agreed to is what the date of the study range would be, you know, whether the study would be done in December or January or February. But it was agreed that it would be done every 6 months, so it would be kind of customary in the industry if you did it first in January, well, the next time you did the study, you would do it in February, and the next time you would do it in March, so that over a six-month or a six individual studies, you would kind of include it every month, and that kind of covers the average. That's how it's historically done in the industry.
When a switch is rehomed, what will happen to the CDRs?
Well, the CDRs will automatically include information of how every call is processed at that time. So, it's one of the nice things about CDR. If you change your switch, the CDRs automatically change to reflect the changes that you've made in the switch.
What happens when a cell site is added to the CDRs?
There would be an additional call record that had a cell site ID in it, and then you would have to go to your cell site ID table and add that record to your cell site ID table so that when you did the extract, it would include that cell site.
You testified earlier that you have experience concerning studies to determine the jurisdiction of traffic. You heard testimony testimony about using one study for all ILECs in South Dakota. How would this compare with your experience on the jurisdiction of traffic studies?
Sure. Well, back before we had frozen spiffs and frozen traffic factors, we typically did a traffic study at least every 3 years on every end office, and every end office of a telephone company had its own traffic factors. So if, in this case, Golden West owned 47 different end offices, each end office has had its own traffic study done on a routine basis, and nobody would even consider doing things about consolidating traffic factors between companies. They didn't even do it between end offices.
There has been testimony concerning the use of SS7 for traffic studies. Are you familiar with the use of SS7?
Yes, I am.
Is this use of SS7 for traffic studies common within the industry?
Yes, it is.
I'm going to go ahead and ask.
And my question to you, in your experience and with the use of SS7 for traffic studies, why is it used?
I'm going to object as lack foundation. She hasn't established that he has any experience of using SS7 traffic studies to determine inter-MTA factors.
Sustained.
Have you ever used SS7 traffic studies?
Yes, I have. We actually write software in conjunction with Nortel to do SS7 analysis. They add some features to their switch, and we write the software that does the SS7 analysis.
And would that be for traffic study purposes?
Yes.
Including inter-MTA traffic study?
Could be for any type of traffic study, including MTA.
Okay. And based on your experience in writing the software for companies, is the SS7 commonly used in the industry for traffic studies?
I'm going to object as to relevance, whether SS7 studies are used in other methods has nothing to do with the study we're trying to conduct here.
Overruled.
Okay. You can answer the question.
You'll have to repeat the question. I'm sorry.
My question was, you've testified that you have actually written the software for SS7. Is the use of SS7 for traffic studies, including inter-MTA traffic studies, common within the industry?
Yes, it's become more common over about the last 3 years when carriers misidentified their traffic that was being terminated and tried to terminate it as the wrong jurisdiction of traffic and didn't want to pay the appropriate rate, and therefore it became necessary for telephone companies and any kind of carrier to figure out alternate ways of getting the correct jurisdiction of the traffic so things could be billed properly.
So is that one of the reasons that SS7 studies are used for inter-MTA and other traffic studies, but in particular inter-MTA traffic studies.
I'm going to object. I didn't hear him say that it had ever been used specifically for an inter-MTA study, and then now she's phrasing the question that way as it's a misstatement of what his testimony has been.
Okay. What it sustained, Darla, why don't you
I can read for that.
I think that was part of your question, but I don't think he included it as part of his answer, your original question.
Mr. Smith, sorry to interrupt it. I'd like some explanation as why you're allowing this line of questioning.
I'm allowing it because a great deal of the testimony in those email chains and testimony thus far has involved the acceptability and use of SS7 data as a means for arriving at an acceptable traffic, an inter-MTA factor. If your question is relevance, we've had an awful lot of exhibits and other things that dealt with SS7 as a surrogate for actual CDI records.
Thank you.
I believe Mr.
Wilson did, I don't remember if it was in his testimony, but certainly in the exhibits that he testified to, questioned the acceptability and validity of the use of the SS7 data for inter-MTA traffic studies. Do you agree with that?
Clearly, SS7 traffic data is not as accurate as the CDR records would be. SS7 is typically used when you cannot get the accurate CDR records from the connecting carrier as kind of a surrogate for CDR records.
And the value of using that would be, as an alternative, is what?
At least you would have a good estimate of what the traffic really was, and you could bill it properly.
You testified that you have experience with regard to the jurisdiction of traffic.
Yes.
Is it common in the industry that a carrier will deliver traffic that cannot be billed at the proper jurisdictional rate because the connecting carrier does not provide complete information?
It's become common in the last few years, and thankfully our legislature has passed a law that makes that illegal and allows the carrier to bill at the highest rate.
I object to that point. He says it's illegal.
I thought that's what it was. Didn't we pass a law?
I sustained.
Illegal connotes a criminal type of action as opposed to what is required of the carriers under the statute.
Okay.
Are you familiar with SDN and the Centralized Equal Access Network in South Dakota?
Yes, I am.
Why was the terminating traffic routed through SDN?
I would object, as this is clearly beyond the scope he's been disclosed as.
He's offering this testimony in rebuttal to the testimony that was offered today by Mr. Williams.
Overruled.
When we designed first Iowa Network Services, Means, and then South Dakota Network, one of the major issues was the reliability of the terminating call records that we received from the connecting carriers. The only way that we could be assured of getting accurate call records was to route them to us through a switch owned by the independent industry. And we went to the FCC and South Dakota PUC and received orders that basically allowed that to happen, and it's been very, very successful.
There was testimony by Mr. Wilson concerning the possible contamination of the data, and specifically contamination by the presence of IXC traffic. There was also testimony that Western Wireless could not quantify the amount of the contamination. Are there methods with which you are familiar to test and measure this type of contamination?
Yeah, there's really two methods to it. First off, remember the exhibit number 45 had traffic overflowing. Every trunk group in a Lucent or Nortel switch has what's called overflow registers. It basically keeps a peg count of every time a call overflows to the overflow trunk group. So one very easy way would be to just look at that peg count register on a daily basis and see what percentage of the traffic really overflowed. The other way that we could do in this case is we could compare the call detail records furnished by Western Wireless with the call detail records furnished by South Dakota Network, who is recording 100% of the traffic going there through their switch, and look for calls that were routed through the IXC network instead of over the intermachine trunks.
Are you personally familiar with such testing mechanisms?
Yeah, we have developed a product jointly with Nortel for the industry to do exactly that.
And are you aware of whether that was the program, the one that you authored, that Mr. Thompson used to test the level of contamination of the CDRs provided by Western Wireless?
Yes.
Yes, he used.
Yes, Larry did use, or his staff did use our program to do that analysis.
For the record, I need to note that Commissioner Saar has left the meeting or the hearing. Proceed. Are you okay, Carla? Okay, all right.
There was a lot of testimony presented by both Mr. Wilson and Mr. Williams about the difficulty of extracting the inner MTA CDRs. Do you concur with that testimony?
No.
And what do you base that on?
Well, based on the fact that the CDRs are going to have that information in them, and they could use the SQL database queries to extract that.
And that is not a complicated and type of process?
That's correct.
Alternatively, they could have provided the raw CDRs. Is that correct?
That's correct. Or they could have also asked Larry to look at SDN and see how much of the traffic was routed through SDN, which is what he ended up doing.
So there were several options
sure.
available.
Or look at the overflow registers and see how much was overflowing.
Thank you. I believe that's all the questions I have.
Okay.
Mr. Coit.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Music.
Good afternoon.
I just have a few questions. With respect to Golden West Exhibit 47, which is, I believe, the one on the easel behind you, and the preprocessor box, and you'd mentioned the fact that the preprocessor can add some information. Depending on what you're trying to do, I assume that that preprocessor could also delete some of the raw data. Would that be correct?
Yeah, that's correct.
With respect to the raw data, the CDR slash AMA data that you have referenced on Golden West Exhibit 47, are there a number of uses that you're aware of with respect to you know, what carriers might use that data for within their operation?
Yeah, normally the CDR records would be used for many purposes. First and probably most importantly, end user billing. Secondary purposes would be network design, trying to figure out when you do have to add more cell sites, could be used for that purpose. Could be used to figure out economic routing, when should we reroute calls via a different route. Could be used for intercarrier compensation, which is what we're talking about here today.
And typically, with respect to that raw CDR data, you know, how long does the company, based on your experience in the industry, how long does the company generally keep that data?
Most of the companies I'm familiar with would have it on their system probably 6 to 12 months, and they would have backup copies of it available for multiple years.
When you say on their system, could you clarify?
On the computer system, readily available to run reports and analysis from.
How often do they dump the data out of the switch into some other system?
Well, they typically do a backup, of the system on a routine basis, probably every day. But so there would be constantly be new days being added and some days being deleted. But most people would keep, 6 to 12 months available online all the time.
So when you say that they would keep it available, it would kind of reside in this
database,
in the relational databases that you've got noted there. You said you had listened to Mr. Wilson's testimony given at this hearing. Do you recall that he offered some testimony about employing an outside vendor for certain purposes?
Yes, I do.
Based on your recollection and your review of the testimony, could you tell what in particular that outside vendor was doing with respect to establishing this sort of a process?
It sounded to me like what he was doing is writing this database query for the getting the data extracted, but it wasn't real clear exactly what he was doing.
So with respect to these overflows, the traffic overflows, which you'd mentioned on your exhibit, the Golden West exhibit 45, by looking at the traffic overflow registers that you referenced or the peg count registers, would a carrier be in a position to tell rather quickly the extent to which any data might be contaminated?
Yes, you would know immediately how many calls were processed and how many overflowed. So you would know if is it a 1% effect or a 0.0% effect or.
So you wouldn't actually have to do any sort of a review or analysis of actual CDR data in order to get some idea of the extent of that contamination.
That's correct.
That's all I have.
Thank you. Do we need a break, or are you ready to go, Mr. Wizarik? Take a short break. Also, some people express scheduling issues. Should we address that now? Harlan, are you? You were one of those. Well, why don't we go into recess and then we'll talk about that. We're back in session. And Mr. Wizarik, you were about to proceed. Are you able to do that, or?
I will as best that I can. As I mentioned during break, I will attempt to cross him, but I'd reserve the right to request supplementation of the record to address some of these highly technical issues as to how our system actually is set up. And what I believe I proposed during break is even if we did something where all counsel, including commission counsel, even if we had to set up as a telephonic deposition to get some of these questions resolved, I'd like the option of making that request to the commission.
What, you know, we, the two commissioners and I just discussed this a little bit. Would it be your opinion at all that if we get to the end of the line here on Wednesday or whenever that is, maybe tomorrow if we're lucky, would it be your belief that that you might need some kind of a continuance in order for you to be able to respond?
I believe I will because some of these documents I received by email yesterday. I'm sure I'm going to have to forward those on. Frankly, I tried to write some of the as many notes as I could in the conversation, but it would probably help to have the transcript so I could ask somebody exactly pointing at the documents and how it works. And so what I'd ask is probably either a continuance to leave the record open, and I offer up the option of doing it pursuant to some type of deposition with all counsel, merely as a fact to expedite to finish out the record, rather because I know how hard it's been for us to get set continuing days with everybody present.
I mean, it occurred to me that for just a fairly limited purpose of dealing with this, that we, if we could schedule, find one day somewhere, that would probably suffice. But with that understanding, I think that's fair, and unless the commissioners believe otherwise, I think that's a fair procedure given the circumstance. Is there any objection from Golden West? Okay, with that, I think we understand then. My understanding is that your cross-examination here today may end up being augmented by additional cross-examination following an opportunity to consult with your experts on this particular subject. Is that a fair statement?
Oh, well, I was thinking more of lines that I would probably testimony from somebody that's familiar with our system to clarify how our system works and whether the generalizations given here are overridden by some specific thing within our system. And I'm not sure that I'd need cross-examination, additional cross-examination at that time. I'd probably rely on those responses.
Let me ask you this. Let me ask it a different way. Do you want to leave that opportunity open?
Yeah, that would be excellent. And I'd like to leave both those opportunities open. And You know, in all frankness, I believe this testimony should have been in the case in chief. And if I put on bring in an additional witness to clarify something, Mr. Music may have the right to come in and say, well, I still think that wouldn't be here or that wouldn't be there, and I wouldn't raise an objection to that. Like I said, my big objection to this should have really been their case in chief. I should have had known he was coming and had the ability to address some of these issues in my response.
Okay, so noted. Please proceed then with your cross-examination.
Sir, it appears that the majority of your work has been with Arlex, is that correct?
Quantity of customers probably more with Arlex, quantity of dollars probably more with AT&T.
Okay. When and just as a background issue, you've never done work for Western Wireless, have you?
I don't believe so.
It's, for example, when you look at the one page you pulled out of these switch manuals, I'm looking specifically right now at GW49. That's from the Nortel.
Yes.
I looked at these switch manuals at one time, and I believe the Nortel switch manual is in excess of 800 pages, correct?
I don't know. It's a big manual.
It's a big document.
Yep.
Correct. In that manual, you never, I'm assuming you didn't find anything that specifically dealt with tracking inter-MTA calls on a wireless switch, did you?
What we're trying to do with this diagram is show how the AMMA is collected from the end office to the data processing center.
Right, but my question was, you didn't find anything in those 820 pages that said this is how you would track an inter-MTA call under this wireless switch.
Yeah, it clearly shows how you would, the cell site would be included in the call detail record, which you would use to track the MTA call.
Right. And we can go back to this extracting inter-MTA CDRs exhibit that you've referenced. This cell site ID, and just so I'm clear on this, where you have cell site ID, MTA is not a field in an AMMA switch.
No, it's the cell site ID is the field in the AMMA switch.
Right.
That's correct.
And I just want to be clear on this, so you know, find what common ground I can and,
okay.
And what's going on, is when Mr. Wilson testified that he had to come up with a database where he had to take a look at the cell sites and then assign an MTA to them, that doesn't come off the switch. You have to pull that MTA and create that parallel table separate, correct?
Yeah, that's correct. That's, I think, what I testified to.
Yeah, I thought so, but I just wanted to make sure we were on the same page.
Yep.
On this, hate to knock you out.
Easy.
The how many fields, how many data fields do you get out of the wireless switch? Approximately.
I would guess somewhere between 50 and 80, probably, something in that neighborhood.
And when you take, so as I understand this, when you take the wireless switch, it originally gives you, let's say, 80 fields.
Okay.
The preprocessor, I mean, Mr. Coit called it deleting, but actually you would agree that the company makes a determination, the preprocessor, what fields they want to collect.
That's correct.
And so when you collect those fields, that's where you, I'm a company, and I say I want to collect the following 10 fields, and then that ends up to be the call detail database, correct?
Yes.
And you would also agree that wireless companies, likely collect different fields than, Golden West would, because they bill their customers and they bill different people.
Yeah. There's probably two or three of the fields that would be different, yes.
When you talk about the call detail database and keeping records, was it your testimony that you'd keep all the raw switch data for several years?
Most companies would keep that in a backup mode for several years, yes.
Okay. Now, you say most, but you're not saying all companies do that.
I don't know what all companies do. All of them that I'm familiar with would keep backup copies of that for a long time.
Okay, but you don't have any factual information that Mr. Wilson lied when he said that we keep it for 90 days, do you?
I think he testified they keep it for 90 days, but it's available on the backups for an extended period of time.
Okay. The preprocessor, if you're going to go in and if the information necessary to do an inter-MTA search was not collected at the preprocessor portion of this diagram, you would have to go in and amend that preprocessor to pick up that extra data, correct?
If it wasn't in the preprocessor, that's correct.
Okay. Do you know whether the IT people at WWC had to go in and amend their preprocessor request to pick up this extra data so they could provide the additional fields?
I don't know what they had to do, no.
Okay. So your testimony today is just general. When you say it's easy.
Trivial.
Trivial. How do you know it's trivial for WWC the way they've set up their system?
I think I heard testimony that they're using Amdocs, which is one of the best systems in the world.
So, but you're not familiar with how it's been deployed or applied?
No, not in their case. Okay. So I am familiar with Amdocs, though.
And when we talk about the call detail database tables, you would, if you had 30 RLEX that you wanted to do this search for, you would have to write the requests to deal, you'll have to write 30 different searches to cover each RLEX.
You would write 30 copies of the same search, putting in different NPA and an X's in each one of them. That's correct.
Different information. Did your company assist Mr. Thompson's company at all in the negotiations or running the data on during the attempt to negotiate a study?
No.
Does Mr. Thompson own a share of your company?
No.
You're appearing here today for free.
That's correct.
Is Mr. Thompson appearing for free?
I have no idea.
Okay.
I thought we all were.
Yeah. Are you just doing this a favor for good clients then, or? I mean, most of the time people
charge. I
think
it's very important for the industry that carriers pay, that traffic is correctly identified and carriers pay for traffic as it's delivered. I think that's critical if our industry is going to be successful.
Okay, but you agree at this point, in time at least, the fields developed under the AMAs and the information you get off the switches cannot be in real time delivered and provide information in real time as to point of origin of call on a cell phone.
Say that again.
Well, there is not a field. There is not a field in the SS7 data that you get that assigns a jurisdictional point for a cell phone call, for a point of origin, is there?
There's an NPA and an X, the originating NPA and an X, and the terminating NPX.
Right.
You're talking in the SS7 message now?
Right.
Okay.
That's the SS7 message, that's the data delivered to the end user. And you, or not to the, LEC, correct? They receive SS7.
The SS7 message is the message that is typically exchanged between switches as the call is processed.
Right. And the LEC would have that in information. And my understanding that you're here today to testify because you think it's important that that information is sufficient to give essentially origin of the call for a cell phone provider?
No, I think it's important that the carrier that terminates the call provides sufficient information so that the call can be billed correctly.
But you're not here today testifying that the system exists under in the industry today that when I pick up my cell phone and call here, that there's an obligation. Well, you're not testifying that the information that comes off the switch could be delivered to the LEC as the information fields are established today, that would give the LEC an idea of the actual origin point of a cell phone call, are you?
Yes. All they have to do is furnish this raw CDR AMA file.
Right, but that is you have to go back and you have to provide that file. I'm talking about real-time information. When that information's delivered, there's no way of knowing whether that call is an inter- or intra-MTA call, correct?
When the call, you've got me confused.
When I pick up my phone and I call Wall,
okay,
the information that's delivered does not give them the information as to where the point of origin of that call was, correct?
The information in the SS7 message now we're talking?
Yes.
It gives the originating NPA and an X, which is correct a high percentage of the time, but not all the time.
Right, but it doesn't give the originating self.
That's correct.
Okay.
But if we wanted to change that, I'm sure we could both go to Lucent and Nortel and get them to include that.
Well, the what you testified about some wireless companies that you've done some work for. In the last 6 years, could you tell me what wireless companies you've worked for?
The last 6 years.
That's the time you've had this new company, and that's
right.
Using that basis.
Harlan, Iowa was a wireless company. There's one in Idaho. I don't remember the name of it. Fruitland, Idaho.
The Harlan, Iowa, is that affiliated with a LEC there?
Yes.
How about the one in Idaho? Is that affiliated with a LEC?
I don't know.
It's just a small local?
Small wireless carrier.
Mm-hmm. You've ever done work for Altel in
any no.
time? Have you given any bids to any companies, VPS, or any of the companies present here as to what your company would charge to write software to perform this function?
No.
I believe I asked this, but you weren't involved at all or assisted VPS at all in the during the negotiations of to trying to come up with the study, did you?
No, I didn't.
The only thing you know about this proceeding is what you've read from the record. Is that correct?
I listened to the testimony on the Internet, read the major portions of the record, and read a number of the contracts and some of the deposition or the interrogatories and so forth.
So when you, I think you said it or at least implied it, that Mr. Thompson or VPS had made a request for all this raw switch data, that's something you think you've pulled from the record?
By reading emails and...
Can you point to one document where Mr. Thompson actually made a request for the raw switch data for all these companies?
The staff is going to have to help me with that.
Well, it was your testimony, so.
I can't find it, no. I mean, I don't have it in front of me.
Do you know if one even exists?
I believe there is some.
Where Mr. Thompson specifically said, send us all the raw switch data for all these companies.
The switch data, yes. I don't know if he used the word raw or not, but I thought it was been discussed multiple times through the last few days of testimony.
And you're not contending that Mr. Thompson at some point agreed to any specific study in this situation, are you?
I thought when they signed the document of the study or the contract that they had agreed to do a study.
Yeah, but the methodology, you don't...
The dates hadn't been decided, that's correct.
Well, the methodology...
I think the methodology was decided. It was going to be based on the originating cell site and the terminating cells, the terminating NPX, and based on the minutes of use.
And you speculate that based on the reading of the agreement?
Yes.
Are you contending that WWC is obligated as a CAMRS carrier to route traffic through SDN?
Yeah, I'm not sure. It's a good question. It should. It'd be a lot better if you did. Then we could have accurate recording of it.
So you would want this commission to require WWC to abandon what build-out it has and route traffic through SDN?
Or provide adequate records so that it can be built properly. I think that's a very good idea.
Have you ever performed an inter-MTA study for wireless calls?
No. I'm not a consultant anymore. I haven't been for a number of years.
Okay, so to the extent that you've testified how easy it is to do this study, you've never performed a specific study to do inter-MTA analysis.
Well, I have collected the data and provided the tools to do it. I haven't done it myself.
You're involved in setting up the SDN network here in South Dakota, correct?
Yes.
And a similar network in Iowa, which actually predated, I believe, SDN,
correct? Yes.
You feel yourself that you're a strong advocate for the rural LECs?
Strong advocate for the communications industry in general, whether that's LECs, wireless, CLECs, and so forth.
But your work, your historical work's been primarily with RLECs and AT&T?
And wireless and IXCs. We had an IXC billing system.
Okay, on wireless, let's go back to wireless. I went back to the last 6 years. Did you ever work with what wireless companies did you work with in the 90s?
I'm not going to give you the dates, but we did one of the very early first wireless companies was a company called Petracom that actually did wireless service off the coast of New Orleans via satellite. They had a switch in New Orleans, went satellite out to the oil rigs and provided wireless services to the ships as they went by. It almost predated cellular, but it was right when cellular was coming out.
Have you? So that would have been before the 1996 Act?
I'm sure it was. I don't remember the exact date. We did it for many years for them, so it probably started before 96 and ended after 96 would be my guess.
What's the biggest wireless company you've ever done work for?
Probably in the 30 to 50,000 customer range.
One switch?
They had one switch, I believe.
So have you ever, for any multi-state, let's say covering at least three or four, let's say covering four states, have you ever written billing software for a wireless carrier that covers more than four states?
No.
Ever written billing software for a wireless carrier ever that covered more than two states?
I don't really know.
Okay. Suffice it to say that you've never written wireless software for any wireless company approaching the size of Western Wireless.
Some of AT&T's at the time was wireless, but most of it was landline.
The So you would agree with me that you don't know how Western Wireless has established its preprocessor, what fields it's pulling, do you?
Well, I do based on the records that they have furnished Larry in the extracted.
That was after additional searches and additional information was pulled from the AMAs.
In the 2004, yeah,
right.
To that data.
That was the data after additional information was pulled, correct? From the through the preprocessor.
I don't know what it was after. I heard it was provided in 2004.
Do you have any current contracts with any of the Golden West companies or your company?
I don't believe so.
Have you done work for the Golden West companies in the past?
Yes.
Do you have any plans to do work or bid on any of their work in the future?
I hope so.
You'd agree with me that if I'm in the process of deploying cell sites, at a minimum, every time you go back to rerun the search, even assuming the no other factors changed, you've got to go back through your cell site IDs and see if you've added cell sites and assign them MTAs to do this search that you've represented on, I believe, GW45.
If you did this query and you had not defined a cell site, in the way most people would do that, that would come up as an undefined cell site, and you would have to go into that table and define that 1, 2, 3 cell sites that were new. That's correct.
That's all I have.
Ms. Wiest.
Thank you. So it's my understanding then that it would be your testimony that Western Wireless could have provided all of the raw CDRs for all of the RLECs on a moment's notice within a day?
Yes.
But the provisioning of that raw data would, once a company such as VPS had received that, would they have needed to receive any further additional information from Western Wireless in order to conduct an inter-MTA study?
They did receive through the interrogatories this cell site information, the IDs and the MTAs and states of the cell sites. That's what they would have to have.
And that would be the only thing they would have to have in addition?
I believe so.
And are you familiar with the methodology that was proposed by Mike Wilson in 2004 that used the 2004 study? Are you familiar with that?
I listened to his testimony. Remind me what you're talking about.
Well, in 2004, Mr. Wilson, if you look at, do you have exhibit, Western Wireless exhibit 14 there, right? On the other side, I think.
Over here?
Right. And if you look at on the bottom, they have numbers and string 8 down there. It has 8 in a bold number on the bottom of that. If you look page through it and find number 8, I'm sorry.
Okay, the page number 8. Yep, okay.
It'd be at the bottom, a bold number 8.
Yes, I found it.
And do you see that in the middle of their methodology as proposed? Are you familiar with that? That was proposed by Mr. Wilson?
Let me read it.
Okay.
I've read through it.
I'm looking through that methodology. Would you think that that would be a reasonable way to do an inter-MTA study?
I would say it probably is reasonable, but it wasn't what the contract agreed to do.
How does that differ from the contract?
They were going to use basically counting the messages and then multiplying it times the average length of the call, and I believe the contract called for using the minutes of use.
Okay.
That's the one thing I see right off the top that is different.
And would a 2005 traffic study, if you did a traffic study in an inter-MTA traffic study in November of 2005, would that accurately reflect the traffic for July of 2004?
If the network or things hadn't changed radically, it would be a reasonable estimate of it. I think the contract called for a new study every 6 months to kind of make sure that as things changed, it would change.
Do you think that's reasonable that a traffic study should be updated every 6 months in order to account for things like network changes?
It should be on some frequency. 6 months would be reasonable if it was changing, you know, reasonably fast. If it was changing reasonably slow, you know, 12 months would be reasonable, too.
And then when you were talking about the overflow traffic, that would be IXC traffic were you referring to?
Yes.
And so then
It could overflow to any trunk group. I used an example of an IXC.
Okay. And I was just trying to figure out if I understand this correct. You're referring to overflow registers. I believe Mr. Wilson testified that one of their problems with the studies is that contamination of IXC traffic, and his testimony, I believe, was that Western Wireless can't quantify the amount of IXC traffic. But is it your understanding that Western Wireless could indeed have quantified that IXC traffic?
Yes.
And would that be without getting any information from the RLEX?
Yes. They could do it themselves using the overflow registers or work with the RLEX and use the SDN data.
And in your estimation, is an SS7 study, is that easier to do than a CDR study?
Really doesn't matter. It's easier to do if you don't have access to the data.
Okay.
If you have both types of data, they're equally easy to do.
Thank you. That's all I had.
Mm-hmm. Commissioners?
How much, Mr. Music, how much expertise would be required to amend the preprocessor in order to gain new data or to capture more data?
Typically a day or two programming effort.
How much expertise would that require, particularly people with a great deal of technical expertise?
An average computer programmer. It's something we do all the time.
So amending the preprocessor, that is not something unusual for a telecommunications company to do?
That's correct.
They would do that on a quarterly, annual basis?
They would do it every time there was any changes in the switch, or if they had some unique data requirements that they didn't have before that they wanted to add to get that data into their database. If there was a new type of switch, they would completely write a new preprocessor starting from scratch normally.
The companies that you've worked with, how typical would it be for them to have someone on staff that would be able to amend this preprocessor?
The large ones would have people on staff that could do it themselves. The small ones would use a contractor service bureau to do it for them.
Okay, thank you. Mm-hmm. That's all, Mr. Smith.
Commissioner Hansen. I have a couple of questions for you, okay. Mr. Music. Looking at Exhibit GW 45, I think, and you'll have to correct me if I'm way off base here, but I heard both Mr. Wilson and Mr. Williams discuss Quest as the way they deal with traffic, and I don't see Quest on here. Can you explain the way that works?
I can't. My understanding was they should be routing that traffic through an IXC that would be through SDN.
So this document here may explain how things, in your opinion, should be done, but it may not explain how it is, in fact, being routed currently by WDS.
I think my diagram would explain how the FCC and the South Dakota orders would dictate that it would be done, yes.
Okay. Just looking at Exhibit, and I think the right one would be probably 45, If Quest were in this loop, would it just occupy the box known as SDN, or would there be a different place where it fits? I'm just trying to.
I really don't know how it would fit.
Okay.
Shouldn't fit.
Okay. Or would it be midway between wireless switch one and end office with a tandem switch in there? Don't know.
I don't know.
Okay. Thank you. With respect to cell site codes, is that what it is that comes out of there
right.
On the AMA data? Is that cell site code something that that particular company and or switch assigns to it, or does it come from NAMPA?
It's just assigned by the local company.
So that's a number that is not, you don't know what number that cell site references without getting that data from the wireless company.
That's correct.
Or other, okay.
I think testify if for example Western Wireless didn't give us that code, we could look at those call records and from the originating phone number for 95% of the calls would be from one NPA, NNX, or one area, and that would clearly tell you what MTA that cell site was in, and probably 95 to 98% of the cases.
Those switch codes, though, don't in any way, they don't match up with anything that has a public standardized feature such as the NAMPA type query records.
No, I don't believe so.
Okay. And so there's no public database available at all that would allow a person to get at that without it.
Except looking at the originating NPA NNX of a high percentage of the calls, and that would tell you the location of that cell site.
Okay.
The only exception I can see that wouldn't be accurate is potentially if there was one right on the border and, mm-hmm. You couldn't tell from that.
Would it tell you if you had a cell site located in a remote area?
If you had a cell site that was not close to an MTA boundary, mm-hmm. I think it would tell you very, very clearly where the cell site was located, yes.
Okay. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Ms. Rogers?
I have just a couple of questions. In response to some questioning by Mr. Wazorek, you testified that you have not done work for WWC specifically. You are, however, familiar with the switches that the testimony was presented that they use. Is that correct?
Yes, very.
Have you worked with those switches a lot?
Yes.
In response to a question concerning the different fields, the data fields that would be different for a wireless versus a wireline switch, even though the fields and the wireless company may collect different fields, the process would still be basically the same as you've depicted on this exhibit. Is that a fair statement?
With the exception in the wireline class or type, you would not have the cell site table.
Okay. Mm-hmm. With regard to your testimony about how difficult it would be to amend the preprocessor, I don't recall exactly your response. Is that a difficult process?
No, it's just a matter of a day or two.
Okay. And you testified that you were aware that Western Wireless has, I believe it's Amdocs. Is that what?
I believe that's what Mr. Wilson testified to.
So then, if you're familiar with that, you are then familiar with the capabilities then that would be available to Western Wireless with that type of system?
I'm familiar with the fact that they're, a multi-billion dollar provider of this kind of systems.
Okay. If you had this system set up, and you take the raw data and you run it through that system, how long would that process generally take once the system is in place?
Typically, once you had the system set up, you would collect, 5 to 30 days of CDR records. And once those had been collected, you would process them through the system, and that would take just a matter of, a couple hours.
I believe in response to a question from Mr. Wysorek about performing the study, I didn't maybe understand your testimony exactly the way he did. Was it your testimony that it would be easy to do a study, or that it would be straightforward based upon the parameters set within the agreement?
Both.
Okay.
I actually thought the agreement was very clear how to do the study. It just didn't specify the dates of the study.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I can't remember who asked you this question, but I believe that someone asked you a question about whether or not Mr. Thompson had requested the raw data. And you have, I assume, reviewed several of the exhibits in this case. Is that?
I've scanned through them, yes.
Okay. I'm going to direct your attention back to Exhibit 14. This is WWC Exhibit 14.
Okay.
And you were on page 8.
Yep.
Okay. If you look above the September 28th of 2004 email message that Ms. Wiest asked you to look at, there appears a September 30th of 2004 email. Do you see that?
Yes, I do.
And is there a reference in that? This would be from Larry to Mike Wilson.
Yes.
Is there a reference in that to raw data?
Yes, it says, I would expect that we will have access to the raw data as well as the results when you have completed the study. Thank you for your help, for the help.
Thank you. I believe that's all I have.
Okay.
Any?
Just a couple. There was some discussion about the keeping record of cell site locations. Aside from tracking cell site locations for purposes of inter-MTA traffic studies, are you aware of any other reasons why a wireless company would track and keep record of its cell site locations?
Well, I would assume it would look at the traffic by cell site and determine where it needed additional cell sites to handle increased traffic or, you know, more load than they had available. So, you know, long before they had even installed the cell sites, they would know where they're going to go. I also, I'm not sure on this, but I would assume they're paying taxes, so they would have to report to the taxing districts. Do they pay taxes? I hope so.
Yeah. Are you aware of the fact that Western Wireless is required under its ETC, under the commission's ETC orders, to track cell site locations and report those to the commission?
I wasn't familiar with that, but it wouldn't surprise me.
So would it be your opinion that, you know, tracking of cell site locations wouldn't be anything unusual for a wireless company?
Well, I can't imagine any company making, you know, multiple $100,000 investments, or if not millions of dollars of investment, without knowing where it's at.
The diagram or the graph that's WWC Exhibit 45, which is the one that Mrs. Smith referenced with respect to IXC shown in the cloud on the right. Now, other than Quest with its long distance operations, the other IXCs doing business in South Dakota that have to terminate traffic to the ILEX, they do route that traffic through SDN. Is that correct?
That's my understanding, yes.
So this particular graph or depiction is really intended to show how traffic would typically be routed if it were IXC traffic. Is that
correct? That's
correct. And so the IXC that you have here in the cloud would probably, you know, if that were MCI or Sprint, this would be accurate in terms of how the traffic is routed?
That's correct.
No further questions.
Tell. Questions?
I just one clarification. I believe my question was, did you see anything where Mr. Thompson requested the raw data on these companies specifically? You'd agree with me that this was just the email Ms. Rogers just cited you. That was a general discussion on how the study would go, correct?
It looked like it was a one of about X number of emails in some email chain, and I just read the one email. That's
right.
Correct.
And you were here earlier when there was testimony that about in this time period of that email, fall of 2004, there had been an agreement between WWC and VPS to take a sampling of five companies. You recall that testimony?
I recall testimony about a sampling. I don't know if there was an agreement or not. Mm-hmm. Just
That's all I have.
Okay. Commissioners, any last questions? I think we're done, and you can be excused.
Thank you. Thank you for taking me out of order also. Sure. Appreciate that.
Mm-hmm. We're in recess until tomorrow morning at 8:30. I believe so. I honestly don't. I don't think I checked. Yeah, let's go there, yeah. I am supposed to lock it when we leave, so I'm going to lock it. And I'm assuming we're here again tomorrow. I